It's the Low Score Podcast with Bobby and Jay.
Not so pleased with yourselves now, huh?
Whoa, watch where you're waving that thing.
No more pigeon shit on my car, eh, Tommy?
Guess not.
You're damn right. Now listen, you know who owns the fastest boat on the East Coast?
Not offhand, no.
Me! And I want it to stay that way. Every smuggler from here to Caracas has one dream. A faster boat. Rumor has it the boatyard had just completed such a vessel for some Costa Rican dickhead. And Tommy, I want that boat. Ah, I thought I got you! Where'd you come from?
These two bros know their MMOs. It's the Low Score Podcast with your hosts, Bobby and Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Hey, Bobby, what's happening?
Oh, not a whole lot. Say, just putting up with the problems that always we encounter whenever we record this thing that we do.
It is. Always a bit of always minor hiccups, but we get it done. Podcasting.
Say, just to let you know, if I'm ever not paying attention, it's because the recorder is not auto-scrolling anymore.
Oh, no.
For whatever reason, so I have to resize the window and then automatically scroll it just to make sure that the show is still recording.
This is some real behind-the-scenes action right off the bat here.
Yeah, I was so ready to do this in GarageBand today, and it just did not happen. I could not get something to work, so we're doing it in Audacity as usual. But this isn't a technical achievements podcast.
It is not. It's the Low Score Podcast. Big episode 41 with Bobby and Jay. Bobby, you're over there.
I am distraught, but over here. And Jay, you are over there, not as distraught because you are not controlling this.
That is correct. I leave all of the technical woes to you.
And it's just us today.
Yep, just rolling.
A little intimate session.
Old school, kicking it back to like big most of the episodes.
Big all but like six of the episodes.
Yeah.
Or seven.
We've got a good, you know, it's slow time of year, not a whole lot of news.
Yeah,
not a whole lot of new games, but we've got a mess to talk about, including your beverage.
Yes, happy National Margarita Day.
Good choice. I unfortunately cannot join you in. I do not have any tequila here at the house.
Say, I do not know who declared it National Margarita Day. Like, what the occasion is, what it has to do with anything else.
Some drunk dude was like, "I need an excuse Monday."
I was like, "Yes, let's
get you rolling."
And so I poured myself a tall cocktail. Rimmed the glass with salt, little rim job.
Yep,
you know
that's the only way to enjoy a good margarita.
Yes, salty rim job. But this isn't. No, I'm sorry. I'm not gonna say that. No, but we have a packed show, right?
Whoa, jam packed, full of jam.
And I think the best way to kick it off is to bring in Jimmy just for a moment.
Yes,
to record
he's here. He's here in studio, and he's been generous enough with his time to just pop in and provide us a little narration Dracula action.
But before he reads and ruins the moment, before he says anything, why don't you tell us where in Castlevania II Worlds of Power we last left off?
Okay, in our continuing audiobook podcast saga of Castlevania, you may remember that last time, you know, Simon has brought Tim Bradley, Boy Wonder, into the world of Castlevania. They're going around trying to stop Dracula. And Simon has warned Tim that Dracula's influence may cause him to start to lose his way. There's, you know, things are not right. Dracula's got a hold over Simon, and he may start to fall victim to some of the seven deadly sins. So next thing they know, Simon and Tim are confronted by a bunch of ghouls. Simon pulls out his whip. Tim pulls out his sword, recently given to him by Simon, and they kill those ghouls up pretty good. But soon after, Simon starts to lose his temper a little bit. Starts to think of eating cake and candy and ice cream and all sorts of gluttonous things and rages out in a wrathful faction at Tim. And Tim realizes that Simon is being influenced by Dracula, so it gives him a good kick in the butt. Then Simon shakes his head and they move on. So then they're wandering, trying to figure out where to go. And for some reason, Simon holds this ring up to a sign, and he knows that if he does that, the love of his life, Linda Entwistle, appears.
Oh.
Tim gets a raging hard on.
You can't do that while I'm drinking.
Yes, I can. Tim Tim finds Linda very easy on the eyes. And
yeah, he's got a little man crush.
Because of Dracula's influence, she cannot be straightforward with her assistants to them. She's, you know, she's going to guide them where to go. So she has to speak in riddles. Luckily, Tim's horrible joke brain is good at solving riddles and realizes that Linda has told them they need to go to a church. And now it's church time.
Church time. Oh, great. Well, that that brings us to the point we're at. So sit back and enjoy this edition of part 4 of Castlevania II: Worlds of Power.
Chapter 9, The Church. The only church in Castlevania proved to be not only the old-fashioned European cathedral type, but a mighty big one. More than big enough, according to Simon, to fit all of Castlevania's citizens inside.
"This way," said Simon, gesturing impatiently for Tim to hurry. His footsteps echoed as he entered.
The inside was lit by candles. Candles! Candles everywhere! More candles, it seemed, than on 1,000 birthday cakes combined. Up ahead, Tim could see Simon walking down an aisle. The place smelled of candle wax and age, and it all seemed ancient and holy.
Tim hurried along to catch up with his friend. The echoes of his own footsteps skidded along the floor excitedly, without the sound of authority in his friend's. "Wait up!" he called to the hero, and his voice came back to him from the walls like a choir.
However, despite his call, Simon was intent upon his goal, the altar. When Simon reached it, he took the handle of his whip and knocked on the wood 3 times. Almost immediately, a man wearing a gray hooded robe stepped out from the alcove. He walked up to Simon. "Yes, my son."
"I am on a quest, brother. I seek to rid this land of the curse of Dracula."
Tim walked up and opened his mouth to make a quip. However, something stilled him. There was something about this place, but especially about this holy man, that said, "No jokes, please."
The monk looked at Simon and then over to Tim. "The monster's evil even penetrates the walls of this church."
"Yes. You can help us, though?"
"Indeed, I shall do what I can," the monk said solemnly. His hand reached back and he took off his hood. His eyes fairly sparkled with good humor, but the frown on his face showed he knew well how serious the situation was. "We are having a white elephant sale of certain items to benefit charity. Have you sufficient coin that you can buy these things?"
"Oh," said Tim. "Simon, this is be part of what Linda was talking about. He wants to pass these things through an indirect manner." Tim rummaged through his pockets and came up with 2 quarters, a dime, 3 nickels, and a penny. But by the time he put out his hand to offer the coins, Simon was already tinkling 3 gold pieces into the outstretched palm of the monk.
"Thank you, Brother Simon." The man turned and retrieved a wooden box from the altar behind him. "Your items of purchase are enclosed." The monk handed Simon the box and began to walk away back into the cloisters of the church.
"Hey, wait," called Tim. "What about the puzzle I'm supposed to solve about the next part of our journey?"
The monk turned around and gazed at Tim quizzically. "Oh, you mean the part about where to find Dracula's rib?"
Tim was astounded. "Shh," he said. "This is all supposed to be hush, hush."
"The rib, my friend, would be at Barclay Mansion. You just leave to the right from here," he gestured, "and take Bulgaria Road straight on into Jova Woods. Now be forewarned. The paths are very confusing there, but I'm sure you'll muddle through."
Tim's mouth had dropped. But what about, I mean, Dracula might hear you."
The monk shrugged. "I'll take my chances." With that, the monk left them.
"Well, there's a brave fellow for you," said Simon. "Now, let's see what we've done got here in this box, shall we?" He set it down on a pew. Mid opened the lid.
Tim was still overwhelmed by the monk. "Wow, what a guy! Too bad the rest of the Castlevanians aren't as brave as he is."
"The rest of the Castlevanians don't have the trappings of a church to protect them. They're out in the middle of all that darkness." Simon pulled out a large flask. "Excellent. Look what we have here, Tim."
"Great, a canteen of water," said Tim sarcastically.
"Ah, but not just any water," said Simon, holding the flask reverently. "Holy water."
"Well, that's all very well and good, but what does it do?" Simon seemed very baffled by that one.
"We shall just have to find out, won't we?"
"What else?"
Simon retrieved 2 whips. Tim recognized them immediately. They were thorn whips. Long, beautifully crafted thorn whips.
"Excellent," said Simon. "The battles with the ghouls damaged my other whip. Now I have a new one, and you have another weapon, if you care to use it."
"Well, I suppose I could try," said Tim. "Still, I'm getting pretty good with this sword, huh?"
Simon said nothing.
Okay, okay, but I am getting better, aren't I? Simon raised an eyebrow. Tim held out his hand. Just how do you snap one of these babies anyway? Tim gave him the whip.
It just takes practice, Timothy. Practice. You keep on doing it, and that's the way you do it correctly. This is one of the lessons that your video games have taught you, is it not? Could you win the games when you first tried them?
Nope, but this is different. They were fun.
Simon looked his friend right in the eye. All of life is not fun, Timothy Bradley. If you learn nothing else from this adventure, then you should learn that. So what else do we have here? Simon reached in, grabbed something, and lifted it out.
At first, Tim thought it was a diamond. And if it was a diamond, it was the biggest that Tim had ever seen. But then he saw it wasn't a diamond. Although it was mostly white, it had streaks of red in it. Tim had never seen anything at all like that in a diamond. It's some sort of crystal? He said in wonder, even as it sparkled and shone like a fireworks display.
Yes, said Simon. And if my hunch is correct, then not only is it a magic crystal, Simon took a deep breath, exhaling with the wariness of the weight of a whole dimension on his shoulders. It is the key to finding Dracula's rib in Berkeley Mansion.
And I don't suppose you mean the barbecue type, do you? Simon looked at Tim with total confusion. Never mind, dumb joke.
You should try to be more serious, Timothy.
Hey, it was my dumb jokes that drove Dracula off, wasn't it?
True, but you lack a certain gravity in your character.
Well, I don't feel like I'm about to float off, if that's what you mean.
This shall be one of my missions on this quest, said Simon. I shall make you a more serious young man.
And I, said Tim, will make you have a good laugh or two.
Huh, Simon grunted. We'll see. He turned and started marching off to the back of the exit of church.
Tim tried his thorn whip. All he managed to do is knock over a bunch of candles into a baptismal font. Their flames hissed out.
Oh, said the voice of the brother, echoing with sarcasm through the church. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Tim wound the whip back up, grabbed his satchel, and raced after Simon.
Chapter 10, A Rib Tickler.
Tim Bradley had seen some big fancy houses in his life, but never before had he seen anything like Berkeley Mansion. Wow, looks pretty intense, he told Simon Belmont.
An interesting word for a house of evil, said Simon grimly. Simon looked ill, as though if he were struggling with something inside of him that he didn't want to talk about. Berkeley Mansion was a bad place before Dracula ever came to Castlevania. It is a house where a great baron once killed his entire family, his servants, and guests, and was there beheaded for his crimes by the law. They say it is haunted by at least 1,000 ghosts.
Tim Bradley gulped. He could believe it. This house certainly looked like a haunted house, from the gothic architecture to the creepy mist that overhung it like a grave shroud. Even from outside, he could smell rotting timbers and the mustiness of hundreds of years of misuse. This was one creepy place.
Prepare, Timothy Bradley, for experiences that shall stretch and perhaps distort your mind. A smile touched Simon Belmont's lips. As we enter the doors of the great house, I'm reminded of the beginning of one of your jokes, Timothy Bradley. Knock, knock.
Tim looked at Simon and then back at Berkeley Mansion. You want me to say who's there? Well, I'm not going to. He took in a long breath. Because I don't really want to know. Tim Bradley had always wondered what a video game would look like if it would become real. He'd always wondered about how the strange zigs and zags of a game would translate into three dimensions, along with taste and smell. However, he truly had never wanted to know what Castlevania would look like. It was too scary to contemplate. However, now he knew.
And the truth was not pleasant. This whole dimension seemed somehow tilted like an old horror movie. This was certainly the case with the interior of Berkeley Mansion. The floors and the ceilings and the walls just weren't square, just did not meet at right angles. The place not only smelled bad, it smelled very bad. It smelled of old shoes and dead socks. It smelled of forgotten things in the back of the refrigerator. It smelled of a terrible past, unearthed, something better off buried. The door was no problem. There was no door. They walked into the main hallway through the sagging open doorway. Draperies and tapestries hung in ruins all about a great hall to the right. Clutter and antiques lay strewn in the wreckage.
Which way? Simon wondered, stroking his chin.
I would think down, wouldn't you?
Why would you say that?
I don't know. Dracula always likes to be close to the earth. Reminds me of the joke, why does a vampire take cold medicine?
Simon made a face.
To stop coughing.
I do not understand the joke, but your reasoning is correct. What else do you see here in this room that gives us information you think might be of use?
Tim surveyed the cluttered chamber. Good thought. You know, the thing about Nintendo games is that there's always something around here somewhere that you need to use somewhere else.
This is not a game of any kind, said Simon sternly. This is deadly serious.
Yes, yes, I know, but I still think we should look for something that doesn't seem to belong here. Something that looks like it might be useful later. Tim began to walk among the odds and ends. Now look at this, for instance. He picked up a broken cuckoo clock. A bird on a broken spring hung out of it like a weird alien tongue. I don't see a thing that this would be good for. He tossed the thing back into a heap of junk. But this, I don't know, it may be a possibility. He bent down and pointed at something on the ground.
What is it? Asked Simon.
It was an arrow, but not just any arrow. It looked like an Indian arrow, with colorful feathers on one end and a stone arrowhead on the other. Look at where it's pointed, said Tim.
Simon looked puzzled. Oh, at the fireplace, so?
I guess you wouldn't know, but these kind of mansions, you always have hidden passages, and they usually have them behind the fireplaces with marble mantelpieces.
Simon looked puzzled. Why is that?
Because of these. Tim walked towards the fireplace. On top of the mantelpiece was a row of candlesticks. For hidden passages, you need handle openers. He pulled on one of the candles. It was just a candlestick and it came off.
Ha! So much for your theories.
Please, Simon, said Tim, still feeling self-confident on the subject. There were 10 brass candlesticks on the mantelpiece, any one of which might be the secret handle that opened a hidden door. Tim tried another candlestick. No go. Another. Nope. He started to get worried. Gee, I don't know. Maybe I am wrong. Maybe. Sticking out from the fireplace was an old grate. Looking over to Simon, he did not see it. He tripped over it, falling flat onto his face. Oof, he said. His dignity was hurt far worse than his body.
Tim, are you all right? Simon rushed over to check. Suddenly, all seriousness again.
Yeah, stupid of me, but I'm kind of a klutz at home anyway. Wait, what's that sound?
The sound was a metallic scraping, like cement skidding along a steel floor. Tim looked around at the same time that Simon did. One of the dusty, cobwebby panels inside the fireplace was slowly sliding away, opening a section of musty, mysterious darkness.
Simon looked down at his fallen friend. It would appear that I have an apology to make, Timothy Bradley.
Wow, there is a secret corridor.
Fear tickled his backbone. On the other hand, how do we know for sure that this isn't a trap?
Simon shook his head. A trap would be more alluring, more obvious. No, you have done well. Let us progress. We, after all, have the torches we got at the inn to light our way.
Yeah, let's just try not to burn down anything. This is like a real fire trap here.
Simon started for the passageway, his torch held up before him. A sudden gust of wind blew out from the passageway, blowing out both torches. The room was plunged into darkness.
Well, so much for that, said Tim. Wait a minute, though, that arrow. You know, maybe there's something magical about that arrow. I mean, it did show us the way to the passage.
What do you mean?
Just a hunch. I mean, this sounds just like something from a video game. You need to find objects, you need to use objects. And sometimes those objects work together. So it follows that the arrow may affect whatever magic we've already gotten.
The crystal we got at the church!
It's worth a try, right?
Tim heard the sound of uncertain footsteps as Simon searched his way back to the arrow. With a grunt, he knocked into something. Tim could hear the sounds of his hands feeling about the floor.
Found it, he said.
Okay, take the crystal and touch the arrowhead to it.
Very well. It was like turning on an electric light bulb. The crystal ignited with a white light that lit the whole section of the room. Simon gasped with surprise and wonder, blinking with the brightness.
I think that'll do the trick, said Tim, brushing himself off as he got up. Still, since you've got the light, maybe you should go first.
Yes, said Simon. Bring the torches, though. We could find a light later, and who knows how fickle this magical light will be.
The passageway proved as dusty and murky as Tim had expected, but otherwise it was bare of danger. They followed it to a set of stairs, which they descended. 3 flights down, they came to a dead end. Simon, using the light, scoured the walls for some sort of opening. He found nothing.
Well, this is a fine fix, said Tim, shaking his head. I don't know, though. It doesn't really make sense, though, does it? I mean, why would there be a stairway down to a dead end?
You are the puzzle solver, Timothy.
You know, you can call me Tim.
Tim, somehow it doesn't sound right. He stepped very close to the wall to inspect it closely, holding the arrow and crystal up for better illumination.
And a very strange thing happened. The crystal dulled in its brilliance. The closer the magic thing got to the wall, the lower dipped the light. Simon stared at this phenomenon for a moment, drawing the crystal back and forth in the air to determine if, in fact, it was the wall that was dimming the crystal.
Something evil is blocking this passageway, he said, which means that it may be something that's protecting the rib of Dracula.
It looks that way, but how are we going to unblock it? We're not magicians. Should I start telling the wall jokes? Hey, wall, what's the stuff between an elephant's toes?
No, no. This time I know what to do. Simon dug into his pack and drew out a large flask filled with holy water they had received from the monk. If indeed this is evil, it is not going to like this. He tossed a splash of the water upon the wall. The effect was immediate. It was as if Simon had tossed a stick of dynamite. With a profound kablam, the whole wall caved in with a cloud of dust. Tim took in a lungful and began coughing himself hoarse. However, he was gratified to see that the crystal was fairly bursting now with brilliance.
You... Right, Simon. Which reminds me of the joke about...
Simon held up his hand. Shh. Look in the next room, Tim. He held forth the white crystal, which cast forth its light deep into the adjacent chamber.
Tim looked, and astonishment overtook him. My goodness!
Well, don't just stand there, came a cackling voice like something out of a rest home for witches. Enter, if you dare.
And see.
Whoa. Wow, what an ending.
I couldn't expect to go there. Dracula's back.
He's back.
How are they going to get out of this pickle?
He was in the beginning of the book. Now, I got to say, it was very forward of thinking for them to write to give Tim a sword.
Yes, absolutely.
That became fucking canon that you could have a sword in Castlevania games.
Absolutely. This you're like, dude, no, I don't use no sword when I play Castlevania.
Yeah.
I only use whips, whips are too hard to use, especially for little kids. So, sword time.
Because the motion of a whip and a sword are so much different.
Totally different.
Well,
one, you have to push the A button, I guess you'd probably push the A button.
Probably.
The other one, too.
That is not one of the things that I have been playing.
No, what have you been playing?
I played a little Mass Effect 2.
Oh, the second in the Mass Effect series.
Yeah, I think we talked about that a bunch last time. Let me get us a little music going here so that we can enjoy ourselves.
Now, we did talk extensively about this last time. You had not finished it. Have your thoughts on the game changed at all? Better, worse, same, but just kind of different? Different things you love, different things you gripe about?
I'm beginning to come around to see the way, Jay.
I'm telling you, man.
I'm beginning to feel like you do. You know, there have been a handful of cool missions, and I'll talk specifically about some of the stuff that I really liked. But in general, like, there was... it was Jack's side mission that I did.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the Chet tattoo chick. And I'm just... The whole time, I'm going, don't care. Don't care. Don't care. Don't care. Don't want to be doing this. Don't care.
I think that's the problem, because it was like they knew... Most of the characters from Mass Effect 1 were not great, like your side buddy characters.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, boring.
Ashley, boring. The other dude,
Kaden, boring.
Kaden was boring. The Asari chick was cool. Garrus was really cool.
Yeah.
Rex was cool. And then the Tali was also boring.
Yeah.
So it was like 50-50. This game might be 50-50, and I would say there's some really cool characters. I think the Geth dude is really awesome. I think Morden's cooler than anybody in both games.
Yeah.
But now there's 13 characters. So you don't get the one moment with each of the characters, and you have to put up with a lot more crappy characters, even if maybe the ratio to cool to bad is the same.
See, I end up bringing Miranda on every single mission because of her techs.
I played Miranda and Morden the whole time.
You know, so I just get this. I went back and I was watching some videos from the first Mass Effect, and I was just like, you know what? This doesn't have that same, it is missing that epic appeal. It is missing that, you're traveling through space, and
right.
This is crazy and out there, and you're doing something new, as opposed to putting the band back together.
Right. It didn't ever feel like I was exploring. It was like, go to this planet, follow this straight line for 20 minutes, and then it's back to the ship. I lost that, that magic of space feeling.
That being said, mechanically,
it's great.
I love it, and it's worth it for that.
It's a totally fun game. I mean, I think they could have been better. But yeah, no, I really liked Mass Effect 2 overall, and I'm excited to see what they'll do next time.
Yeah, I am too. So my favorite mission so far was the Asari side mission.
Yes.
Whatever their quest is called.
Now, I don't know if we're ready into spoiler territory, but they're at that point, you can pick which Asari you want.
Oh, really?
Okay, so I don't want to spoil it, but you know how there's a confrontation between two Asari?
Yeah.
Like, you bring one in.
Yeah.
You do not have to leave with that one.
No way.
Yes.
Oh, if
you,
wow.
I believe if you push right trigger Renegade, then she goes kaput, and you take her daughter's side. And then she joins you back on the ship.
That is crazy. I had no idea that that was even an option. That just like didn't even exist in my mind. Like that could be a possibility. Wow.
Yeah. It's like if you're going the Mad Evil route, because that chick is psycho.
Yeah, she is. But like, so that was basically kind of like a dating sim side quest.
Totally.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was about like picking the right dialogue options and making yourself appealing because you want to get in with this person so that you can go back to her apartment and corner her. And there was something about it that just felt like I actually cared about the character for once. And I cared about what I was doing and my actions for the first time ever in like choosing those kinds of like, oh, here are the right dialogue choices to make this situation work. I actually felt as if I wasn't just choosing them because I knew they were right, but because I felt they were right.
Yeah.
And just I absolutely loved it in terms of that.
There's a couple times that's cool. There were, like I said, I played pretty straightforward, good. But there were a couple missions where I went Renegade. Just because I was like, no way, that dude screwed up. Like, there has to be, like, a line somewhere. Even if I'm going to be pretty forgiving.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty cool.
And one of the really cool moments about that mission is that you go back to her apartment. And she has, apparently, you know, she's super strong. She has amazing mental abilities, and she can control your mind like the Asari do. Like look into your eye, and
yeah, she's got the biotic powers,
and you can't do anything. And you know, she's talking to you, and it pops up with the dialogue options, except they're all grayed out because you cannot overcome what she's saying. Like,
yeah, it's
the
awesome.
Only thing you can do is say the one thing that she wants you to say. And I was just like, yes, that is the way to represent these dialogue choices in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I was, yeah, a huge fan of that. So, in general, I would say I do like the game, but I do not feel compelled to play it every hour like I have with some games. And I'm not getting that vibe that I got at the end of Mass Effect 1. But
no.
Like you, interested to see what they do in 3. I do not dislike the game, but I'm not feeling it.
No, it's really disappointing as a sequel, I feel. I was like, man. It's like they forgot about the other stuff that made it cool. That was not the shooting. They were just rehashing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that's more Mass Effect 2. I still need to finish it, so you'll hear about it again at least one more podcast, I'm sure. What about you? What you done?
I played a little bit of Team Fortress 2 based on Drew's recommendation
Drew.
We should play that game more. That is a really good game that is not for me, and here is why. All of the shooters that I've been enjoying recently, namely Modern Warfare 2 and Battlefield 1943, are short. The rounds are usually between around 10 minutes, like maybe 5 to 15. You die often, and resurrecting is really fast. Like, nobody has a lot of health. Like, and one of the things I like about Modern Warfare is I'm not all that good at strafing and, like, winning in a big firefight. But if you can sneak up on someone and get one or two good shots, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very satisfying for, like, where my skills are, like being aware of stuff, sneaking around. Team Fortress 2 is the opposite. Everybody's got a lot of health, even the more minor characters, and it's about these big, long matches that are often, you know, 30 minutes in length. So it definitely, I think, rewards skill a little bit more. I think it's a tougher game overall. The worlds, as opposed to something like Modern Warfare 2, Battlefield, where they're built out like big flat areas,
mm-hmm.
these are much more structured, like big buildings and levels and finding hiding places and like really knowing the level. And it seems to reward like dedicated players more in that way. I was really interested at playing it after like finally having a good sense of like some of the other games in the genre. And I can certainly see the appeal. It's a slower paced game. It is definitely, there's more of like a war of attrition going on, but I found myself not being very good.
And that's what turns me off from all those kinds of games is I know, you know, it's just, I'm not going to be that great at it. And why bother trying to get into it if I'm not gonna be able to take the time to really learn it like I want to learn it.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons I bought it and never played it.
Yeah, so it's definitely not a bummer. I play it. I'm like, I get what you're saying. This is clearly like a really well-crafted game. I get it. I might try to go play it some more, play some more classes, but I just the endurance that game seems to take. I don't know if it's for me.
Fair enough.
But there's some TF2 talk.
Yeah. So I played a handful of things casually. I goozexed a couple games.
Okay.
I goozexed Freedom Fighters, that PS2 game. I think you liked it.
The game's great. No, I played it on PC.
Okay. Yeah, I got the PS2 because it was $5.
Fantastic.
Cool. Let's see. I picked up Sigma Star Saga, which I played all of like 3 minutes of and got my ass kicked. It's a horizontal flying ship shooter, Gradius style, but it was just way too fast and on the GBA for me. And I was like, I can't see what's going on. This is moving too fast, and my eyes are not doing that. So I played that for 2 seconds. But the last game I played, I bought it just on name, Little Red Riding Hood's Zombie Barbecue.
All right, man.
So it's a DS game.
Yeah, okay.
It is. It's not a rails shooter. It's more Hummingbird shooter style, but think of it like the Contra top-down levels. So you're standing at the back, and you can run side to side, and you're shooting. And you're just tapping at the screen as Little Red Riding Hood, because you were in the graveyard because the woodsman, you know, who saved you from the wolf the first time, died. You went to visit his grave, but then zombies came alive. And so now you're trying to fight your way through zombies. And you just, like, tap on the zombies to shoot them, and you get, like, a flamethrower and a shotgun. And it's okay. Like, it was...
Okay.
For $5, like, sure, for the novelty of having a weird game like that...
That's definitely worth it. If it's like, if it brings a smile to your face, and you're like, yeah, all right.
Just having it on my shelf brings a smile to my face. That's all that matters.
I'm glad you bought Freedom Fighters, because you and everybody needs to play that game.
Because I thought about it too, and Steam had this sale once, and I was like, yes, grabbing it. Need this game on PC. And I bought Freedom Force, which is like the comic book themed Diablo, like top down.
That game is okay.
That game is okay.
Yeah, it's a clicky, totally fun, harmless, mindless game. But Freedom Fighters is legit good. Like, it got, like, 9s and 9.5s when it came out. It's just, like, awesome, like, squad-based shooter with, like, really varied missions, really, like, really deep combat, cool setting. Like, it's basically like a Red Alert type history, except, like, the Russians, like, win. Mm-hmm. And they're, like, they're invading America, and you gotta deal with shit.
Oh, speaking of Red Alert, this had not happened last time we podcasted, but they released Command and Conquer Red Alert and Tiberian Sun.
Yeah, Command and Conquer, effectively Command and Conquer 2.
Yeah, for free for the PC to download. And
they just threw the ISO files up and they said, "Do it."
And you have to, you have to patch the shit out of them and then download like.
Yep.
It's not DOSBox. It's whatever, like, the thing that you can use to mount virtual disks. So I did all of that stuff, and I played some Red Alert.
Nice! Did you?
I played the Soviet campaign because I am an evil Soviet. Dude. And I forgot, like, the first mission is, like, kill civilians.
Oh, yeah.
Kill all the civilians. And I was like, my God. I forgot. We could totally get away with stuff like that back in the day. Now there's sensitivity issues.
I want to download the original Command & Conquer and watch the amazing cutscenes.
Yeah. Dude, we went out to this beer bar, and I was talking with my friends about the amazing cutscenes. Not only was the intro movie, like, ridiculously awesome when they did the motion capture, or the actual video stuff with the actors, and then the motion capture, or not motion capture, the CG of the tanks rolling through and Hellmarch playing.
Yeah.
Also, the trailers that they had for other games, I want to say one was like Masters of Magic was one of them.
Okay. And
something else. I used to just watch those because I was in awe of how good the graphics were.
It's nuts. Like, considering that at that time, you were fucking playing a Super Nintendo.
Yeah.
You know, like this was just way ahead. Like, way bonkers ahead.
I mean, like, you're looking at a time when you can't even contemplate, like, Toy Story. Like, what that means to have that kind of 3D animation.
No.
And I was just like, oh my God, this is... I would just sit and watch them. I'd just watch it, load it up, and watch it.
They're good, man.
They're still there. They're still in the ISO, so you can watch them.
You watch them anytime you want. Go get them.
And that Hellmarch song.
Dude, yes.
That is a song. One of the most rockin'est songs.
Every once in a while, I'm like, man, I should get some Command & Conquer. I'm like, I wonder how terrible they would be on the Xbox. I'm like, probably pretty terrible. but
oh yeah, no, that's just PC it.
I downloaded the demo on PC and that shit was complicated, man. I don't know if I can do it. I had trouble with Warcraft 3.
Ah, no, that's easy. It's almost too easy now, actually. I like the too simple.
Huh.
Yeah, but yeah, I played a little bit of that.
Well, good. In the past, or in past podcasts, I have said I played some Assassin's Creed, didn't get it, put it aside. We have been told all around review time that Assassin's Creed 2 is awesome. We had Jimmy on here last time talking about how Assassin's Creed 2 was awesome. So, after beating Mass Effect 2, I didn't have anything to do, and I decided, well, all right, Jimmy kind of taught me how to play. I got to use my blocking some more, be a little more patient. And I popped in Assassin's Creed, and I beat it.
In one sitting? Or?
No, over the course of a week. That's a pretty long game.
Yeah?
That game is really interesting.
Interesting can mean many things. What do you mean by interesting?
It means it's a combination of, like really spectacular game, like, ideas and planning. And then, like, they were like, oh, fuck. They built these awesome environments and, like, these really interesting, what equate to, like, boss battles and, like, a neat cryptic story to wrap it all up in. And they were like, shit, this game is 45 minutes long. Okay, we got to pad in a bunch of mundane bullshit. Let's make three missions and then just hit, like hit the function call button again and again and again. So you have to do each mission like 50 times.
No.
I mean, not that. It's like...
But that is no good.
I found myself like real thin on gameplay, real thin. Like, it's basically like you go into a city, you climb up these towers to like uncover... Well, like at which point you push a button, you can like see other things that unveils other missions and stuff downtown. And so you're like, you're pickpocketing a guy. You've got to like follow a guy into a corner and interrogate him. You've got to like save a citizen. There might be like one or two other missions. You've got to like maybe assassinate somebody in the street. But it's always like the exact same like routine again and again and again. I played most of the game with headphones on listening to podcasts.
Aha.
Because like most of the like actual story part that takes place in the early part of the millennium is not good. When is it? It's like 1190 is when it's set. I forget when. Like Italy. I don't know.
Renaissance-y?
But something about like the idea behind the game is so good. There's three big ass cities they built, and they're big and they are beautiful. They are fun to be in. They have a lot of personality. Even though there's all kind of the same color palette, they feel really distinct. They did a good job of making these cities felt like they grew up organically. It makes sense that people who were just building shit would design a city like this. It's really fun to jump around roofs and dive around, trying to escape people. All the mechanics work pretty well. Sometimes the controls get a little wonky. It has that Prince of Persia problem where like the A button does too much. So like sometimes I will run up the wall when I wanted to climb up the ladder like one step to the left. I'm like, no, why would you do that?
You just ran.
Or like I'll jump into the ocean instead. I was trying to jump on the boat like half a centimeter to the left. I'm like, no, what are you doing? So there were some big problems there, but it was so different. Like there's what I found like allowed me to bypass some of the like shortcomings, and they're pretty big shortcomings, was how, like I said, how unique it felt. It didn't really I guess Prince of Persia might be the closest thing, but it's like if Prince of Persia was an open world game and like you weren't a pussy, like that would kind of be it.
Okay.
I thought the way that they tie this like conflict between the Assassins and the Templars and like connect it to the modern day like future storyline was really clever. It definitely felt like a prequel to the ideas and world that they had built. But that part for me was the most satisfying, like the short clips where you go back to the modern day and like see what's going on. So I'm really excited to play Assassin's Creed 2 now, because if they fix a lot of the controls, I can see this game being incredibly rad. But even then, I would recommend playing through a little bit, getting through the like wonky tutorial that I don't really feel tells you what to do very well. Because I thought part of the problem they didn't articulate was how easy it is to kill somebody. You can just assassinate a dude in the middle of the street. And as long as you don't do it like right next to another bad guy, Nobody really cares. Nobody really noticed. Yeah. And at first I was like, shit, I can't just stab a dude in the middle of a crowd. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And as soon as you kind of embrace that, you're like, oh, okay. All of a sudden these missions become way more doable. So I don't know if I would recommend beating Assassin's Creed, but it is absolutely worth checking out. It also looks great. I don't know if I said, but the design of the cities and the environments are really cool and really unique.
It interests me specifically from a city perspective.
You'd get a lot out of it, I feel, because it's completely different from, like, you know, Grand Theft Auto or something like that. And just like it's like the city seems to have more life. You can go into any buildings, but there's no cars or anything, so it's entirely densely populated with people. And the graphics do a good job. There's no like popping or anything. It really feels like there's a lot of people doing a bunch of different stuff. There's merchants, and it feels far more alive than even like a Grand Theft Auto 4 city does, where it's just cars and like maybe one or two people walking around. Very, very vivid.
Sweet. You know, I'd like to say that I would like to play those games, but I look at my shelf and I'm just like, you know what? I have other things to take care of.
This is a game. If somebody looked at me and was like, dude, that Assassin's Creed, that game is not good, I'm like, yep. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Like, that game has really serious problems, like borderline unforgivable problems. But
it's still fun.
I still dug it. Yeah.
So I suppose you can't really argue with that. Let's see, what else? What else did I do? What else have I played? I have to check. Oh! I'm playing a song, Zombie Lounge, right now, by Maze Dude. It's a Earthbound remix. Can you hear the music, Jay?
I sure can. I'm rocking out.
Okay, cool. I played Plants vs. Zombies for the iPhone.
Okay, now this game, did this also come out on Xbox Live and PlayStation Network?
This came out on PC. I don't think it's...
Oh, on PC.
Don't think it's been on the other two. I'm not sure. You can double check that.
I'll check it out while you're talking. You might be right.
It's a PopCap game, so you can guarantee that it's going to be addicting. And I bought it for PC and didn't realize it. The other day I looked at my Steam account and I was like, oh, yeah, I own that game and never played it. It must have been on sale over Christmas or something.
That makes sense. There's a lot of stuff on sale.
But that was it may have come out at $19.99, like a $20 game. Maybe it was $15 or $10. I can't remember.
Okay, so yeah, it's on PC, Mac, iPhone, PSN, and Xbox Live.
Oh, so it is on those. Okay.
Yep.
iPhone is the way to play it.
That's ridiculous. How is that possible?
It is totally the way to play it because you can do two things at once with a multi-touch. So
that's interesting. I don't know if you know, but controllers have multiple buttons too. Like, you can do more than one thing
at once. You can't press in two places at the same time.
No, that's true.
Right. So, the idea of Plants vs. Zombies is, I don't want to say it's like tower defense, because it's not like the normal when everyone like walks in and follows a path and you shoot at them, but it's basically the same thing. There's a grid, and the grid is supposed to be your lawn. And the zombies are in the streets, and your house is on the left-hand side. And you are to plant these flowers that like grow sun, and sun is your resources, so you use that as like money so you can buy more plants. So when you collect enough sun, like sun things, you can plant something, and you can plant like a little pea shooter, and it just like shoots in a straight line across the screen.
Huh.
And then after you get like a couple things set up, like you know you might like plant a couple flowers so that they're producing the sun so that you can buy more stuff later, you place a couple things on the screen and the zombies just start walking toward the house from the street. And the zombies all have different characteristics. So there's just like the normal zombie that like a single pea shooter could take out a normal zombie.
Gotcha.
There's a zombie with a bucket on its head, so it's stronger because it doesn't know it's getting hit. There's the zombie with a cone on its head. There's the zombie Michael Jackson that raises other zombies from the dead. So he'll like walk into the screen, like moonwalk onto the screen, and raise four zombies around him. So you have to deal with that.
Too soon.
There's daytime and nighttime. So at nighttime you can use mushrooms, which is another kind of plant.
That is real old school. I remember back in the day, like after Ocarina of Time, man, you couldn't take two steps without the game having night and dark.
This changes it in a significant way.
That's cool.
Because you're using totally different stuff at nighttime and dark. But at the end of every level, you get some new plant to plant, some new form of attack. So you get like a pea shooter, and then you get the pea shooter that shoots like two at once. You only have to plant one of those, and it does double duty. You get a pea shooter that shoots down three different lines. So it shoots out in front of it, and goes. You get like a little mushroom that shoots right in front of it, and you can be free, or you could get one, like a mushroom that if they eat it, they turn around and they go back and start eating other zombies. Like, dudes come in on balloons, and there's a big cactus that pops up and pops the balloon.
So this is pretty frenetic, because this all happened pretty fast, right?
Yes, this is happening very fast. But because it's PopCap, they figured out how to balance it such that you're always just, like, barely hanging on, but you can always pull through.
That's
awesome. Unless you screw up. Some levels, like, at the levels I'm at right now, they've added a pool down the middle. So you have to plant lily pads. You can plant stuff on top of them. And then dudes come in and swim, and some of them can swim underwater, and some of them, like, swim above water. And it's constantly just, like, creating all these barriers with all these new things that you're doing. And I think everybody can develop their own style of play. I don't think there's a single, like, right way to do it.
That's awesome.
And, man, like, if I'm like, oh, I'm just going to, like, play, I'm going to play a little Plants for Zombies. I'll be in bed, like, in the dark under the covers for 2 hours.
Oh, Christ.
And the reason it works so well on the iPhone is because you can touch what you want to plant and touch the place you want to plant it basically at the same time.
Oh, so that, like, is cool.
Left thumb, right thumb. Left thumb, right thumb. So it's much faster than you could if you were clicking or dragging or other things.
Right. Does it have that PopCap feel where, like, you can just redo it again and again and again and again and again and again?
Like, redo the whole game?
Yeah, like, you don't get sick of it.
I'm not sure, because I played for, like, 6 hours and...
All in the same garden?
I'm not sure how far I am through the game. I have not beat it, but I know that I have a lot to go, so...
That's nuts.
It just builds and builds, and it is so much fun. I'm sure it's good on the PC and in other places, but if you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, it's $3. Buy it.
That's a good price.
Buy it. You will not regret it.
Badass.
Yeah. Yes. God. I was on the MARTA... Brian in the train, and I looked up and was like, oh my god, this is my stop, because I focused. And I never do that with any game, especially fucking mobile games.
Yeah, Jesus, who cares?
Because, yeah, like, most of my opinions of iPhone games are...
Right.
Even DS games are kind of...
Certainly recently, yeah.
But this, this is something else.
Nice.
So, I got
rad.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing an iPod, or an iPhone game.
No, I'm just burning the battery life. Ooh, it's bad. It's real bad. Okay.
So now we bring into our new segment, possibly reoccurring. Not really new, but it's should Bobby blow some money? Because I don't know why. Like, you just get whims.
I do. This is kind of like a... It's a pressing matter for me.
It is.
I'll sit at my computer during the day and I'm just like, I want that. I want to buy that. I should buy this. I should buy that. And of course, I am a PhD student, so I do not make money. I lose money.
Right.
So, first question. And I posted this to you in email, but I wanted to reiterate it here. Mm-hmm. Should I buy Bad Company 2 day one?
Okay, go ahead.
The pros of buying it day one is that Amazon right now has a $20 credit. You get a $20 credit for it.
All right.
And I also already have 10 bucks. So I'm basically spending 50 for it, and I get $23 to spend on... something else, which I'm sure I will find in the next month. So it brings it to a reasonable price, kind of balances everything out. I love Bad Company. I really enjoyed the multiplayer in Bad Company. And I can't remember who it was recently that tweeted, but they said, like, it'll blow your mind. I'm just like, oh, I need it. I need to play that game. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you that I thought Bad Company 1 was totally rad, and I also really dug the multiplayer. I would think that if you feel like you're really going to play some multiplayer, I think it's absolutely worth $50. Absolutely.
Because by the time I got around to Bad Company multiplayer...
It's done.
It's done, yeah.
That's the problem. Because if you could wait a year or two and snag this game for $20 and get a great deal, have some fun with the single player, which I'm sure will hold up. The first one held up really well. The problem is you're not going to get as much out of the multiplayer. You know, we got Halo Reach coming out. Modern Warfare 2 is still going to be really big. So this will definitely have some life for at least several months.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think you're going to get something out of that, you're absolutely going to get your money and your time's worth. Yeah, I can't say enough good things about the first Bad Company. I know you and I both like that single player. Add a good amount of humor and charm and lightheartedness that is often lacking from, like, your military-themed first-person shooters.
Mm-hmm.
It played differently than in terms of multiplayer than a lot of games. It focused so much on, like, destructible environments and, like, again, like dense sets of buildings rather than kind of open plains where you're looking for, like, cover and stuff. You know, cover on like bushes and trees and rocks, as opposed to like, oh shit, like behind buildings that like your opponent could shoot a rocket at, and then your cover is not there anymore. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that might not be a bad deal. I would say that if you can look inside yourself and be like, yeah, I'm really going to get several hours of good solid multiplayer out of this. I think, especially with all the discounts you're getting, I think it's a good buy.
See, I've always considered myself a very like second tier person when it comes to things.
Right. So, me too. I really buy games full price.
Second tier, like I always buy like that, the other one, like, so.
Oh, okay. So you're like, I don't want to buy Call of Duty. I want to buy Battlefield, Bad Company.
Right. I'm not going to play Modern Warfare. I'm going to play Bad Company. I wasn't playing Counter-Strike. I was playing Day of Defeat. Let's see. I wasn't buying Transformers. I was buying GoBots. You see?
GoBots were cool.
So that's kind of how I've rolled from basically my entire life. Is there's always like that second thing. The other one is what I was playing with. So, yeah, I'm not sure. All right, next question for you.
Okay.
Should I pick up BioShock 2?
This I am more skeptical of.
See, I've grown less skeptical of BioShock 2 over the past couple of weeks as people have played it and said, yeah, it didn't need a sequel, but this is a lot of fun, and it's still a pretty good game.
Yeah, it seems less special than Bad Company 2. Because like Bad Company 2 was like, man, I can really see how they could improve on that, take some lessons from like the leveling up system in Call of Duty 4, which like I assume every shooter has now, because that makes so much sense. BioShock 2, though, even if it's mechanically better, and I'm certain, here's the thing, I'm certain it's fun. It is the question, should you go out and pick it up? Of course, like I'm going to pick it up. For $60, though, with other stuff coming out, I don't know.
What about this scenario? Pick up the game, play it, and then trade it away on GooseX for, you know, $50 or something. So basically the cost of it was $10.
Well, if you could do that, I imagine you'd have to beat it pretty fast, because I don't know if the multiplayer on this game is going to have as many legs. I've heard it's better than people might expect. But again, I mean, if Bad Company 2 is be like, I don't know if how many people are going to like permanently turn away from Modern Warfare, even less so with a novelty like BioShock 2.
Yeah.
So if you beat it fast, if you were to buy it and beat it in a week or two, I bet you could get some good money off GooseX. After that, you'll probably get diminishing returns.
Because like, well, I could rent it. And like rent it from a store, some sort of brick and mortar Blockbuster.
Right.
But I don't feel like doing that. I don't have a Blockbuster account. I could get a Gamefly subscription, but I don't want to do that because I don't want to be caught in that whole Gamefly mess.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would basically be it. And then if I wanted it later in life, I could buy it for like $20 somewhere down the road to have on my collection.
What I did a year and a half ago is they have, if you're a new customer, really great Gamefly deals where you can get a month for like $6. And that's pretty good. If you're like, I'm just going to pay $6 and play BioShock 2, because you beat it in a week, or in a month, I mean.
Right.
And if you're smart enough to turn it in, like, and I believe if you cancel, you have a week to turn in your game before they will charge you again. So, like, you get a couple more days with it. That might be an economical way to do it.
Hmm.
But I just don't know, unless you're really itching to play it, it seems like that's one I could definitely wait on. Because I feel obligated to play it. I'm not all that interested in the multiplayer. So I just don't see that one having the potential legs that Bad Company could have. I'm sure it's a solid length. It was like 10 or 12 hours. That was probably the length of the first one. So I don't know. I would lean towards no.
Okay.
Unless you were really excited about it.
I think you're right. I think I really want to play it, but my hopes for it may outshadow my actual desires for it. All right. This is the second of the session. Not should I buy, but stop me from buying. Stop me from buying DJ Hero for $80.
Here's what I've been thinking about with DJ Hero. I might have said this on the podcast too. First of all, $80 I think is still too expensive for that. We know DJ Hero 2 is coming out. Activision has confirmed that.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality in like hardware, like based on the Guitar Hero and Rock Band franchises, goes exponentially up from the first to the second iteration.
That's true.
Okay, like the Rock Band 2 drums are stupid better than the Rock Band 1 drums. The Guitar Hero 2 and 3 guitars were stupid better than the Guitar Hero 1 guitar. And so I feel like even though that's actually probably a fair price for the controller and game, I just worry like you'll buy it, dig it, and then 6 months later, DJ Hero 2 comes out with like a way sturdier controller. Because playing DJ Hero 1, I was not, I thought it worked fine, but I was not overwhelmed. It felt a little shaky to me.
It did. I always, especially like the fader, I never felt that the section, like, because it is something that is very specific about like stopping in the middle.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like the click when you stopped in the middle wasn't very good.
I completely agree. I would always go way too far and screw that up. If I were to go all the way left or right, it was no problem. But yeah, they need a better way to tip you from that. I just feel like I'm excited. I hope DJ Hero 2 comes out. It's a reasonable price. It's got a great controller. And then I could probably get DJ Hero 1, like the disc.
On the cheap.
On the mega, like, dumb cheap.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I would not buy it. If it were 40 or 50, like a real, real cheap price, mm-hmm. Yeah, probably go with it. Why not?
But 80 bucks is 80 bucks is a lot of money.
Still a lot of money. It's definitely more fair than 120, which is ridiculous. But I still think it's too much.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you. Lastly, my buddy got my other friend for his birthday a copy of Animal Crossing City Folk for the Wii. And he bought himself a copy so that they could play Animal Crossing and go to each other's towns and hang out. And in my three margarita state, I was like, oh man, I should totally get Animal Crossing.
What are you fucking doing? What are you talking about?
We talked about getting it on the podcast. We totally talked about it when they announced it. We're like, if one of us buys it, we all have to buy it.
We did, and then none of us bought it because we came to our senses.
Well, yeah, but...
Here's the thing. You know what I bet? Here's what I bet. I bet if you got it and played with your friends there, I bet it would be incredibly fun. Once. Mm-hmm. You would have one really fun experience. It'd be fun. You get to check out everybody else's town. You go, oh, look, your hippo is a bitch and mine's actually really cool, huh? And like, that's really fun. You get the fruit and you can plant the other people's fruit in your town and that's worth a lot more money. But then the next time you go, it's like, oh, these are the same towns. This is the same action. The Animal Crossing for me, I would even understand like trying to convince them to buy it on the DS because that's the way to play that game.
Well, the problem is one of them doesn't have a DS. The other one's DS.
DS. You can get a DS for a song these days.
Yeah, but it's not. Doesn't mean that someone who doesn't play video games is just going to go buy a DS to buy a single game.
Sell your Wii and get a DS. Better value.
Well, I do not disagree on that point.
All right. So I guess you're in a bit of a pickle because they've already committed to this.
Right,
I mean, you would be paying $50. I think it's $50 for a game you would literally not play. You've already played that game.
I would play
like,
it, yeah.
And got sick of it. Because it's the same as a DS game, which is the same as a GameCube game.
All right. My mind's made up. You're
just
right.
Don't do it.
Thank you. Saying that, oh man, we have 22 seconds left on this song. We can...
Just play it out.
So you made up my mind for me. Got to spend money in some places. Got to make priorities. Got to buy a Little Red Riding Hood zombie barbecue.
I got a question. I'm still. I guess I'm going to ask you a question. Should I buy Final Fantasy 13? I'm pretty committed to buying it already. Is my point. Is like the only reason I didn't bring it up immediately. I've read the reviews. I've seen the mixed feelings on the battle system. But I just feel like I've been this way since I guess 10-2 because I bought 10-2 at launch, got the big book, hunkered down, got 12 at launch, big book, hunkered down. I'm like, yeah, it's an event. It's going to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I'm going to spend a dumb because I will definitely buy the guide. It's like the one franchise I'm still like, you got to buy that big dumb.
Yes, you do.
Strategy guide. You just have to.
If you play within your lap. My answer is, well, actually, I think I said this in email, maybe to you, but at least to Jimmy. If Giant Bomb gives it 5 stars,
right,
I'll buy it.
Okay.
If they give it 4 stars,
no thank you.
I'll wait. I'll wait. No thank you. Maybe not. Like, it needs to be something that's just familiar. That is, yes, definitely, this game is awesome and you need to play it. From people I trust.
The only thing I'm worried about is people have been clamoring, and I haven't seen any solid ones. People want to know how the Xbox version looks. Because they've claimed, like, oh, it's going to look the same. Like, my guess is that the video will not look like the cutscenes will not look as good as the 360. It'll have to be compressed more to fit on
PS3. The cutscenes will not look as good as PS3.
They won't. Yeah, they won't look as good on the 360.
Oh yes.
They will look. They will look better on the PS3 because I'll have more room on the Blu-ray. They won't have to condense it.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if the graphics in general were a little worse in the PS3. I would be pretty disappointed if they were way worse. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really mind if the reviews say, yeah, the PS3 is a little better. You should get it. I'd be like, well, that's fine. I don't have that option. I'll get it. But if they're like, it's like real bad on the Xbox, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm like, do I wait until I get a PS3?
Do you think you'll get one sometime down the road?
I do, but not soon. I would say probably the soonest would be like birthday or Christmas, which would be, you know, fall, winter.
That's a good time to...
Get me one. Yeah, get me one.
I'm happy with mine, and actually, like, I find myself switching back and forth. Like, I use my PS3 as my DVD player because Xbox is too loud.
Yep.
But I still use the Xbox to stream Netflix because that's the one that's always hooked up via Ethernet.
No disc. Yeah.
No disc. Like, that browser on the PS3 Netflix, very slow.
Yeah.
It's just like, click, click, slide.
That sucks.
It's definitely not meant for that interface. But, yeah, somewhere down the road you should get one.
Cool.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Let's move on to news stories when we're doing some weird news.
Yeah, some interesting items of note. We don't usually do these things, but I thought that these were worth talking about. Number one, this was linked on IGN.
I had not seen this until you linked to it, and I immediately got super, super, super excited.
Rock of the Dead.
Fuck yes.
Typing of the Dead. Using Rock Band peripherals or music game peripherals.
Typing of the Dead for the PC. Typing of the Dead is a fickin' fantastic. Now you can guitar riff zombies and they will die.
Yeah, so as they come towards you, you play, you know, a handful of notes and they die.
That is awesome. That is fucking brilliant.
My concern is that they will not do a good job of making it a rhythm game. Like, that... It will not be rhythm-based such that you feel like you are doing something by using this controller that would be different than using any other controller. Like, yes, I'm pressing these buttons, but, like, I kind of want to do it, like, frequency or amplitude style.
So,
like,
I see.
Killing some zombies, like, creates, like, one beat, like, res. You know, you take care of a bunch of things. The music comes in. And it could be – it doesn't have to be, like, techno – but I want it to be – I want it to be, like, rocking, like
– That's a good point. I definitely do hope they do a pretty good job of, yeah, at least having to make some sound. That if I think res would be the best way to do it, like not make you like strum in rhythm, but make it so it affects the surrounding music as you killed zombies. That would be pretty good. But that is a great fucking idea.
Very, very good idea. Next up on the list,
World of Tanks.
Fuck, dude. Worlds of Tanks. This is an MMO where you play as tanks. Like, this is like the type of thing that you and I would talk about when we're espousing how much we know about MMOs.
Totally. This is the new expansion for World of Warcraft.
Right. You play as a tank.
I don't mean like a really like strong, like slow, beefy fighter. We mean like a tank. Yes. Like a tank.
Yeah,
I mean, like what? Well, that's it. Tanks rolling around. You can play light tanks, medium tanks, heavy tanks.
You shoot people.
Shoot people. The trailer is fucking fantastic. I don't know if you watched it.
I can't wait for the expansion, Tanks versus Helicopters.
Oh my god! But I don't know, if you should watch the tank because the tank starts. It's like a 45-second trailer, and the first 30 seconds is just like an orc and like an elf wizard fighting, and then like. Tanks just come and roll over them. And then it says tank power. And then it says World of Tanks. And that's it.
Let's see. Oh, that's loud.
I can't hear you. It's too loud.
Is that better?
It's better. Still pretty loud. So here's the orc and the elf. They're fighting.
Orc stands up, raises his sword and shield into the air. The ground starts shaking, and a fucking tank just rolls over him.
Just rolls over him. Tank power.
World of Tanks. Tank power. Yeah. Whose idea was this?
I don't know. It was pretty good.
I kind of like this. I don't know about that.
I don't know if that sounds fun, but it sounds hilarious.
I would play it for free,
but tanks are not fun to drive in games, as Resident Evil taught us.
That's true. Oh, damn it. That's like its fatal flaw.
Yeah, it's that it's tanks. Once you get past the tanks are hilarious.
All right. Great concept, going to be stupid in execution.
Yes.
World of Tanks. And our last item of note, this affects you and I.
Dude, yes. It's more Borderlands. Now, this is actually, it's the what is it, Secret of General Knox. It looks awesome. This is the third in set of DLC, and it seems like the third DLC for Fallout 3. And that level cap up, it actually like adds on to the end of the main game. It's not just some weird side thing going on. It's supposed to be pretty long. It's still a reasonable $10. I really want to play some more Borderlands. I think I might be all in on this one.
I will too, because someone asked me recently if they should download the DLC for Borderlands, the Zombie Island of Dr. Zed.
I heard that one was okay.
And I was like, okay. And then Mad Moxie's Under Dome Riot.
Heard that blue.
Yeah, from the Giant Bomb people. They're like, you play, you never get anything. There's no reason to play.
Yeah, there's no items, there's no XP.
There's no like interesting level design. It's just waves and waves of dude. It's like horde mode without a soul.
Right. That is dumb.
But yeah, this one seems like it is actually worth purchasing. And you know what? Love Borderlands.
And it's out this week. It's like they've been being real cryptic, saying like, yeah, it'll be out pretty soon. It's out. It's coming out this week.
It's Borderlands time.
Time to get you one.
I still have points to get in Borderlands.
Nice.
Like the original, not the DLC stuff. I'm not getting any points in those. Not going to buy those just for points. But yeah, I still need to hit level 50.
Yeah, I have not hit. I don't think I've hit level 40.
Oh, I've hit level 40. I'm pretty sure.
I gotta start my second playthrough. Then I can get some mad XP.
I think Kevin is playing. We should play some weekend.
That would be pretty good. Get all up on.
Record a Borderlands podcast. It'll be way better than the Forza podcast because we can actually pay attention to talking as opposed to
yelling at
cars.
Played a bunch more Forza 3 this weekend. That game is still good.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I would like to get back into it. I have a handful of things I need to take care of first, but I'm going to
level 38, starting to be year 5. Pretty excited.
Yeah. And that is it for our items of note this week.
Indeed.
Okay. So Jay.
Yes.
Let's discuss.
We're discussing. We're
fucking damn it. I was like, let's.
We're not cursing.
I wanted music.
Let's curse.
Let's discuss.
All right. We're discussing now.
Yeah, this is discussing music.
I feel like doing some discussing.
I feel like being a travel agent in hell.
Absolutely.
Because this is from Grim Fandango.
Grim Fandango, yeah. So I feel like discussing about something disgusting. And that is about a lack of credibility in game reviews.
Okay, so we're going to kick off our discussion with an item that came from GameSpot. And Jay sent me a link, and he's like, whoa, dude, check this out. And I was like, what? Like, why are you reading GameSpot? Like, what is this? So Justin Calvert, the awesome British dude.
He is actually, I don't know if he's editor-in-chief, but he's head of the reviews section at GameSpot.
Posted something where they pulled down a review at GameSpot. So, Jay, tell us what you know about that.
Okay, so there's this new game that I, to be honest, I'd barely heard of before this review. The game is called Global Agenda, and it is a massively multiplayer third-person shooter. It's, like, based on Unreal 3 technology. It's a PC game. It's, like a science fiction, spy, action, shooter type thing. You know, it's got, like, PvP, it's like team-based shooter. It seems kind of interesting. It is not supposed to be all that great. The reviews have been pretty mixed. GameSpot gave it a 5.5, which was one of the lower scores. Mm-hmm. And several days after the review was posted, they pulled it. And it's because the community, the Global Agenda community, was able to find the reviewer whose name I cannot find. And they find out that his character name, based on like screenshots where it shows like your character and all that, their name was Doofus Jones. And one thing this game does have going for it that seems pretty interesting is this incredibly robust online stat tracking system. where you can look up your record and it shows you exactly how long you've played, when the last time you logged in was, your complete battle record, like where and who you fought, what kind of mission it was, how many experience you got, how much damage you did that fight.
It's insane.
It's this huge amount of stat tracking. So I looked at this guy and they said, this dude played for less than 6 hours. He played in one class. He didn't make any sort of alliance.
Right.
Which, like, there's different factions in the game where you ally with and there's different bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. They're like, this guy, like, could – I mean, even if he played as one character, 6 hours is not enough to experience any kind of massively multiplayer game, period.
It's, I mean, that's barely enough. I would say that's not enough for any game.
No. I mean,
unless,
I guess –
unless your game is 6 hours long. That's...
Yeah, unless it's short, maybe a puzzle game, I can maybe see 6 hours being enough. But it's pretty short on any standard.
Mm-hmm.
This came to the review of, like you said, Justin Calvert, and he completely agreed. And they put up on their website on their under review, which is their reviews blog. They said, man, like, this guy screwed up. Even in the review, which you can't read anymore. You know, it criticizes, it used different words like the first dozen hours or so are really bad, kind of saying, like, I played for about 15 hours in the game. And basically, like, this dude lied and made it seem like he played for way longer than he really had. So they pulled it and people were like, yeah, no kidding. So, like, that's pretty shocking. Like, you don't see that happen that often.
Yeah, it's...
For
GameSpot specifically, it harkens back to the hubbub, the incident, whatever you want to call it, with Jeff Gerstmann, what may or may not have happened when his review of Kane and Lynch went up and it was pulled and they said, you know, this is unprofessional. It seemed like a normal review to a lot of us, but for whatever, you know... We think about that incident when stuff like that gets pulled down. Like, why did this? And I like that in this case, it is very specifically, like, no, we just... People called him out, and you know what? You're right. This reviewer, whose name we can't find...
Right.
...did not do a good job and does not deserve credibility as, you know, a game journalist. Despite what you may think about the profession in general, there's still a lot of responsibility.
Well,
people look to you. You are a gatekeeper. People, you know, before they open up their wallet, they open up their web browser. And
right.
They turn to you. So
it's particularly sad it happened to GameSpot, like you said, because of how much play that Kane and Lynch review did. And that's getting more play than this one. But that review, they didn't even pull it. I think they temporarily pulled it, or maybe they temporarily pulled the video review, but then put it back up. Like, that review's still up on the site. And it seemed really clear, like, their advertising was all over the site, and like, it caused Jeff Gerstmann to get fired like right after that.
Mm-hmm.
You would think like their brand was irreparably damaged, or at least near irreparably damaged. You'd think like they would have put their cats on and be like, we cannot let this happen again. Like, we are a big fucking news site. We're owned by CBS. Like, we can't be pulling shit like this. And so to have something like this, that's way more embarrassing. Like, it even seems way more clear cut. It's not even just like a publisher was unhappy. It's like the community was like, this sucks.
Right. This is just not, you did not do your job. You didn't do your job. But it raises a lot of issues.
You know, like, this is clearly not the way to review an MMO. It's clearly not the way to review any game. But what is the way to review an MMO? That's what it got me thinking a lot about. Because, like, obviously at the beginning, it's going to take a while to, like, get a feel for it. Wait till there's a lot of people so you get that massive experience. You've got to wait for them to iron the bugs out, because in a big, you know, server-based system, there's always a lot of bugs at first. And I imagine, like, how good the game is, like, should you buy it, like, really waxes and wanes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, now might not be a great time to get into a game that's been out for... I mean, it might be a good time to get this game, but, like, a game that's been out for years and years, might not be a good game. Might not be a good time, since everybody's playing so much high-level content, there may not be as many new characters. However, if, like, an expansion comes out and everybody's making new characters see the new stuff, like, maybe that's a good time to jump on. So I can see, like, really waxing and waning, like, whether it's a good time. If gameplay and stuff holds up, it's just a really interesting... like, way. I mean, you can certainly do a snapshot, and I think that's kind of valuable.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain place in time, being like, yeah, this game's kind of fundamentally good or fundamentally bad or whatnot. But I'm not sure.
But there's so many categories of what it means to be a writer in the business. And I don't mean someone who writes scripts for video games, that kind of thing, but we mean people who write about games. So Jay and I have established like a kind of typology of these different, I don't know if I want to call them professions, because not a lot of them are professions, but groups of writers. And the first being what we would consider like journalism. Like,
right.
These are people who write about industry news. These are people who go to events and cover that kind of thing. They may, you know, only post people or only post earnings reports and consider right. themselves journalists, which is kind of hack. And they may actually do, you know, legitimate journalism, which is, you know, delving into companies and maybe if there's an issue like, you know, company is overworking its employees, they would dive into something like that. But they can also just be interested in covering the field in general, what it means to be in the video game industry.
Right. They are usually very much of the moment. They want to let you know what's going on right now. They want to let you know, like you said, reviews are definitely a big part of journalism. If a game's any good, let people know what's coming on the horizon. You know, most game websites' main goal seems to be less about fandom and more about like your buck. Like, what should you be aware of? What should you spend your money on? What's cool that's coming out? Though there are definitely a few cool websites and blogs that, like you said, do it more in the form of long form journalism, who do like real research and like are interested in the field as it is growing and evolving.
Our next category is people, and this all of course, multiple people have different personalities that they take on, different types of writing that they do. But the other type would be features journalism. That would be, you know, long form previews of games, explorations of topics, whether it be delving into violence in video games, that would be considered like a feature. It could be top five best asses. That is, you know, that may not be the right. best feature, but that is the kind of feature writing as well.
Yeah, and these seem to be more timeless as opposed to like a review. It's mm-hmm.
Don't say review because review is next.
Oh, you're right. Well, but this would be more like
coverage.
Here's what the deal is with the game in kind of like an unobjective viewpoint, like this game is a third person shooter. You're doing this. Here's the environment. Here's the developer. Blah blah blah. That kind of gives you information. Like I said, exploration of topics, like bigger long form features, stuff like the list that we might do that kind of takes into account like the medium as a whole and makes you think more about it. You know, I can remember places doing like Japanese games, or like looking at like when the trophy system come out, like best games for trophies or all that, like exploring how that enhances or, you know, mm-hmm. makes the game lame, stuff like that.
Our next category, as we hinted to, is reviews. And I think right. that it's important to think of reviews on their own, because a lot of what I hear when I read a lot of these websites that are talking about, you know, what should game writing be all about? They're like, oh, these reviews and giving scores to games are so bad. And I'm just like, well, I would like a score because I only have $60 and I want to know what is the best thing to spend it on. Like, I'm not going to spend it on what you think is the most, you know, interesting innovation in one particular way, but the rest of the game sucks, or what is the most culturally relevant game possible. Like, no, like, I'm looking for a review because I want to know, do I want to buy this game? Because do I want to sit down and play it and use my time and experience the game?
Right. I think that's good. I think it is different from journalism in that respect, that it is about – it's answering a question. It's should you buy this game. It's not an investigative report. It's not digging in or anything like that. It's about like, I played this game and I'm going to share my experiences, sum up my experiences, and give you some information, be it a score or not, or, you know, and my writing, and say, here, you take this and see if this makes sense for you if you want to go pick this up.
And this is, in particular, one place where it's important to have people whose tastes you identify with so that you right. know whether or not the game is for you. Because you can read a whole range of reviews, and there may be someone who fucking loves JRPGs, and that's how they're going to review it. They're not going to review it like, well, this game is totally great if you like JRPGs, but for the rest of the people, you're not. Like,
right.
They're just going to write about that one specific group who's interested in the game.
They may give it a 10 out of 10. And they may be justified in that, but that still doesn't mean it's for you. I think that reviewers usually, and I think this is good practice, assume you're reading the review because you have some interest in the game. You at least, you know, not that you're interested in playing it, but you're like, I care about how this game is turning out. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you don't care about how Final Fantasy XIII is going to turn out, you may not care if it gets a 0% or 100%. So, like, you're not going
to... Right. What does it matter to you if it is given a 10 when your favorite game of all time is given a 10 as well? Like,
right, right.
And unfortunately, for a lot of people, that does matter.
It's harsh. You know, I don't know how much it is now, but I remember certainly in the, like, early days, I would say even, like, 5-10 years ago, you know, it's just like forum fodder, people saying, like, oh, my game got a 9.8 and your game got a 9.6. And so it's obviously, like, that's the final word. It's way better. And when a score is presented, like, on such a finite scale, it's hard. Like, you feel like a reviewing community is telling you that. Like, yes. Like, we are so confident in our ability to assign a numerical score to a game. Like, you can use it to compare things like that. Like, but when you're more vague with, you know, stars or less gradation between the numbers, you allow more games to, like, fit under each umbrella of score that you create.
The people who generally try to fight against reviews is what I would type as criticism.
Right.
And when I say critic, I don't mean, like, the movie critic who goes and gives 5 stars. Like, that's your reviewer. When I say criticism, I mean people who are interested in exploring games, not whether or not you should buy them, but other merits of the game, how they fit, how they're culturally relevant, how they're significant to the industry, how they fit into our lives, what we should take away from them, what other games should do with them. You know, they're going to pick a specific piece of a game and talk about it, or, you know, they'll write about racism in Resident Evil 5 or something like that. Like, that, they would say, oh, you know, this is what this game is doing in this sense. And a lot of, I think a lot of critics are the ones who don't like reviewers because they believe that what they are doing is more important, that they are somehow rising above this dollar amount that should be put on a game and really delving into what the soul of the game would be. And there's certainly a place for that, but I don't think that they should lump themselves together reviews or try to distinguish themselves as being better than reviews. It's just another form of writing about games.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, they're not even comparable. They're both completely fascinating. Like, the fact that, like you said, like, racism in Resident Evil 5 is an interesting topic, doesn't shine any light on whether the game is fun or not. And while exploring the race issue may give you reason enough to want to play the game for yourself and experience that aspect of it, because that's a really interesting question. Mm-hmm. It doesn't answer the question of, like, yo, it's Saturday morning, I want to spend some time in front of my idiot box. Is this game fun or not?
Right.
You know?
And I assume that we will get to a point when we start playing games because of those specific things that they do, where it's not the most fun game ever, but
and
it engages
great.
You, like, at your core emotionally, and that will be awesome. But I think we're still working toward that.
I think we're still working towards it. But you know, it's like any medium. Sometimes you read a book or watch a movie to really challenge yourself or to engage in it. Or sometimes you pick up, you know, a pulp novel or, you know, a dumb comedy because you want to, you know, sit back and have a laugh and enjoy yourself. And that's,
yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like,
no, how do you put a value judgment on something like that?
People, you know, are like, well, oh, movies, they've, like, surpassed this, you know? Like, movies are about serious topics. I'm like, fucking, what, the new Kevin Smith movie with the cops?
That movie looks great. I mean, but no, not, like, no.
Like, that's...
No, obviously not.
They still fit into this larger framework of all the things in the world, and in a lot of senses, they're equally as important. So, back off.
Yep.
This is the area that I fit into, I think, the most, which is academic writing.
Right.
And academic writing is very, very peculiar, because I think a lot of critics also believe that they're academics. They might have read a single academic book and said, oh, yeah, I totally understand all these topics, and I can speak to them in this way. Academics will pursue issues more in depth, but I think the thing that really separates what a critic would do and what an academic would do is the knowledge that they bring to the subject. You could tell an academic paper because it cites sources, it cites other theories, things that have gone on, other pieces of writing. You know, academics are constantly engaged in just a discourse with a community that's not just that has been informed by things that have been published, and there's something to be said for, you know, books that go through the publishing process and other people have cited and said, yeah, this is a really good idea. It's one thing to say, oh, yeah, like, this guy wrote this blog article, so he must be right.
Right.
Versus, well, this guy wrote this book that, like, 15 other people cite, so there's probably some merit to it, versus the guy who got left behind, or the woman who got left behind, I should say, because the stuff they were writing, you know, just never caught on and or never found its place in the world of writing. So it's a hard one, and I pride myself on citing things in my writing and bringing a lot of background into it. And you can write about a whole slew of topics. So you can write about what I do, which is like the video game city. And I can write about GTA 4 and a lot of the issues that you might write in a review. Like, how is this mechanic broken and how does it affect your experience of it? But I got like these like 10 things that talk about how people experience space. And that's like all part of it. And like, I don't think that it's better than any other ones. I just think it everyone sort of needs to realize the differences in their type of writing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mean, just like you're saying, you know, it would be a worse world if any of these categories went away. Like, if there were not these avenues of expression or consumption of writing about games.
We need all of them. We do.
We need all of them. And I think, like you said, it's absolutely like having something that's been vetted by an incredible number of people and has been edited by people, and like being able to present as like a tome of like, yes, here is this book we can give you as a lasting like piece of information is really valuable. You know, alongside that, our final one here, the off-the-cuff writing, is the exact opposite. There is something valuable about blog entries or Twitter posts of a completely unfiltered, usually not even edited by the author, stream of consciousness. Here's what I feel like writing for today.
Right, here's my idea right now.
And it is completely the opposite. Like, I feel like you said, if you're reading a blog entry thinking it's some kind of tome that has been vetted, like, you are dumb. But if you think of it as like diarrhea of the head, like, this is, I'm going to send this out in the universe for it to be lost. Like, let's, you know, consume it now of the moment. Here's what I'm thinking about. I think that can be really interesting and can spark thought of your own. It's like, to me, it's like that seems like not something that you hold in sight, but something like you have a dialogue with.
Right.
And like, you know, it, for like people who are interested, like good blog articles and posts and links and stuff, to like continue to dialogue and like prompt thought about games in ways that may fit into some of these earlier categories or may not. They just be ramblings.
And sometimes that what it prompts is the idea that this person is an idiot. They don't know
Absolutely.
What they're writing about. And
Absolutely.
And that sparks a thought. It's the idea that anyone contributing is helping in that they are either supporting or people are reacting to
right.
this whole ecosystem of writing.
Even reading an idiot and thinking like, this is why this guy is like, this post is dumb, like, is a really engaging and worthwhile task.
Yeah.
And can heighten your enjoyment of games.
Still, I think in this case, we should only give so much credit to everyone can write.
Totally. Everyone. It's the best and worst thing about it. Everyone can write.
Yep.
There's no limits to your, you know, social status or your income or, you know, accessibility to anything like that. But it also means like any tard with a computer can spit whatever they want on the internet.
Especially me.
So more than any other category, like, you have to like really engage, know who the writer is, know who's posting. Because, yeah, I mean, there's often a right to dismiss this stuff on site. But it's I think it's a distinct category in that it's so like amorphous. Like, there's no like real set thing of like, here's what you can expect from like somebody's blog. Like, you know, even like a blog on Wired or something. You're just like, who the fuck knows what kind of crazy shit? They go off on some genius tangent. They're probably more likely not going to go off on some like weird minutia of something that's dumb or, you know. But yeah, it's definitely a new, like, new media type of expression.
I don't know what to say specifically about these. So what I look for in a video game website is exactly what Giant Bomb offers. And
right.
we follow them, and we talk about that website because, you know, Jay introduced me to GameSpot back in the day, and these are all previous GameSpot employees.
Yeah.
And, you know, they developed a sense of community with each other and with, you know, their audience. They understand who their audience is. They have their very specific way of going about it. They have, a lot of them have really good tastes, and they know how to you know, explain their thoughts and
right, and they really embrace like, this is the kind of game I'm interested in. I'm gonna tell you straight up front, like, I'm going to inject my personality into this review and my tastes. I think I've been thinking about it too, and I was going to save this off for later, but the most genius thing they've done, and like maybe the most important thing to happen to like game features, reviews, journalism in so long is the quick look. I think it's like the most ingenious thing I've ever seen. We're not going to try to write and tell you about what this game is like. We're gonna show you, warts and all.
We're just going to play it.
We're just going to play it, and we're going to talk about it while we're playing it. It's such a simple concept, and so like, why didn't anybody think of this before? I don't want it, like some edited trailer or even some edited footage by a gaming outlet that doesn't have any interest in the particular product, like any like vested interest in the particular product. Like just two people sitting down saying like, yeah, we're going to play a little bit of this game for half an hour and then cut the camera off.
And some people would say, oh, a half an hour is not enough to know any game. But like for the purpose that it's supposed to serve, a half an hour is a lot of time with a lot of games.
Because they do a really good job of not unless it's like really like horrible, mm-hmm. making some kind of value judgment. They're just like describing their experience saying, oh, I didn't figure out the controls, but I just did. And trying to be like really blunt and stuff. And I often find it's enough to give you like a thumbs up, thumbs down perspective. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I'm done with this game or like that's cool. I often find they're great after the review has come out too. If you know they gave it 3 or 4 stars, like in the medium category, like their like reaction to the game combined with like you actually seeing it and watching it often will seal the deal for me one way or the other. And I find it's usually extremely helpful. But it's just like the best way to illustrate what a game is all about that I've ever seen. I love that idea.
Mm-hmm. But of course, Giant Bomb's not the only place that we read. Yeah, they have a ton of other websites that we go to. Do you want to go into it right now? Shall we?
I think we should. I think this is, brings us right to it.
I don't know if we need to be so rigid as we normally are. I think we can elaborate on a lot of our comments.
Yeah.
But say there's nothing wrong with when it's time for...
Good morning, Captain! Well, good morning to you, sucker. Till you meet another mule skinner.
This is Jay's idea.
Down on your new mud run.
The list.
So we had all sorts of different topics prepared, ideas for what the list could be about. But what we decided to go with is to roll into our discussion.
Roll into our discussion.
It's kind of what the list was originally. It was, let's have a discussion about very specific things.
Absolutely.
So this week we asked you, recommend to us 5 people who write about video games.
Yep, 5 people. And this specific people, not necessarily gaming outlets on there. Like, oh, I really love Kotaku. It's like, right. No.
Yeah, like, pick a writer. So we got some submissions. Jay and I have our lists prepared.
Yep.
Say, these may not be your 5 favorite or the 5 best or the most amazing of all time, but these are people when you'd say, like, if you had to add some stuff to you, like your RSS reader right now, I recommend you go out and read these people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
I can always wait while I hear a little more Mule Skinner.
Like, listen to this all day long. You know, I thought about starting my class with this. It's in the mornings.
That's what you do early. Yes. Good morning, Captain.
9 a.m. Good morning, Captain.
So I'll start off with a person I bet's on your list. We've been talking about him ad nauseum, sort of.
Little water boy.
Whoa, where'd it come from? Bring him up.
Bring him up.
Sorry. Let's
Don't be shy now. Come on, catch a ride.
Who's the first person on your list?
Wow, I was talking about Jeff Gerstmann.
Jeff Gerstmann, gee, he's on my list. I was going to save him for last, hoping that you would save him for last too. But
no, I saved him for first.
Okay, well done.
I just figure he's the greatest, and we've been talking so much about his review on his history on GameSpot, history on Giant Bomb. Not only does he have a great sense of humor that he brings to his website, he is a real love and serious approach to video games that I really really admire. He takes games seriously, but not too seriously, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. People don't know, he was at GameSpot for over 10 years, ending up as the head of reviews there. And he left after a scandal in 2007, when in early 08, with former CNET people, founded this site, Giant Bomb. I guess co-founded along with Ryan Davis, but I think he got the ball rolling from the very, very beginning. Now it's a group of four editors and an intern and a web staff, and they write about video games.
Is Drew still an intern technically, or is he a full-timer?
I don't know.
I think he may be a full-timer.
I think he may have been upgraded to full-timer. He does a lot of their video stuff. Mm.
He's sort of a bitch, a lackey.
Yes, he's but definitely a
I want
bitch.
His job so badly.
Oh, that would be pretty good.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty good.
So one of the things that I love about Jeff Gerstmann is that I never get the sense that he's the type of person who wants to be in the industry for other reasons.
No, I completely agree. There's a lot of people who use game writing, just web journalism as a stepping stone to web design. And that's fine. Game design. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's certainly disappointing from like my perspective as somebody who wants someone writing about games. But this guy's like, no, I want to write about games. And like, I will put in whatever work is necessary to like give you good reviews on games.
Yeah, it definitely shows in the work that he does. He understands the industry. He's the type of person on the podcast, you know, will just randomly trace back a company, like the four companies before that, like who came from where and like what owned who, and he knows the industry inside and out.
And what I love, I think more than anybody, because there's a couple people like that on the internet, no pretension about him. Like, no, he's not like, I'm going to show you how much I know about ColecoVision. He's just like, no, here's like this. I think that game spawned out of this other game who was the designer, like used to work over here. And you're like, what are you talking about? I mean, he'll even quiet the people who work there sometimes. It's like, okay, like, all right.
Sure.
Sure. Whatever, man.
He does a very good job of what he does.
Yeah. Certainly, like, if you want to follow, like, what you would traditionally think of as like a reviewer, like a game reviewer, journalist, preview writer, like that traditional like GamePro, EGM, GameSpot, GameSpy, now Giant Bomb. He's your core guy.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of our listeners know what the Giant Bomb is, but if you don't,
you're missing out. It's literally the best video game website on the internet, next to lowscorepodcast.blogspot.com.
You already know what that is. So my first two people on your list, you're not going to know.
Okay.
The third person you will, and the fourth person overlaps with our list, so I'll save that.
I'm going to say, of my four, you'll definitely know two. You probably know one, and I don't know if you know this last one.
All right.
Well, why don't I just spout out Jeff Gerstmann, you pick somebody.
So the next person I want to suggest to you is from pressstarttodrink.blogspot.com.
Okay.
Tagline being, let me scroll up so I can see. Tagline being, bringing together video games, academia, and alcohol. Which, I don't know if you know this, but those are my interests.
I did not know you liked video games.
Or
the others I knew. No, yeah. I knew you liked booze and academia.
Yeah.
Video games, however.
His name is John Vanderhoof. Hoof, something like that. And I just really enjoy his writing style. He has what I would consider to be something like mine. It is a casual academic approach to topics, ranging all over, just kind of like spouting off the top of the head, but not just the spouting off the top of the head. Oh, here's this great idea I have. It's like, here's this idea I have. And it's like weird how it fits into all these things. Like, check out what these people have written, and it all like comes together. And I just really appreciate his style of writing. So he writes a lot about race issues. So that he had a bunch of stuff that was about,
oh, like Forza and Burnout,
Zing,
Gran Turismo,
race and sex. But also interested in a whole mess of stuff. Like he has an article on embodiment representation in video game culture. And he picks people, he picks writers, and riffs on their ideas and brings them into video games. And I think he does a good job of it. So rather than me explain specifically how he writes, I recommend you just going to pressstarttodrink.blogspot.com.
Nice. I'll start with somebody else who I'm guessing might be on your list. I know you know him. You actually introduced me to him by way of a book, and that'd be Mr. Chris Kohler.
Yes, he's on my list.
from Wired. I am a latecomer to his fandom, but he runs a blog over at Wired.
Game Life.
Which is really interesting for a lot of reasons. But the thing I like about him most that I feel like he does better than anything else is comment on Japanese game culture.
Yes. He went to Kyoto University.
I did not know that.
For his master's or something like that, and did journalism. Like, he knows Japan. He wrote his book about Japan. What's it called?
Yes.
Press Start?
It's like the history of Japanese arcades.
Power Up. Yeah, the history of Japanese companies and their influence on the video game industry, which is something that a lot of people forget.
He's a fascinating dude. Anytime TGS rolls around, you've got to watch him. He does a lot of video blogs from Japan. He has the past couple of years, which have been fantastic, giving you a real inside look at Akihabara, you know, which I'd heard about from millions of people before. But he was the first one to like bring a camera in there and just like tape around and look at stuff. Crazy knowledge about like the N64 DD and like weird Japanese only stuff like that. Always has interesting things to say on his blog. And he does a really cool podcast. There's a bunch of other people on that, but I don't know if you listen to the Retronauts podcast.
On occasion.
He is a force on that, and it is really cool. It is not – honestly has not been as cool. Every episode used to focus on something. Like, we're going to talk about the Super Nintendo Final Fantasies or the Nintendo Mega Mans.
Right.
And they have kind of gotten away with that, and it's become honestly a little less retro. They will sometimes talk about current games like compared to old games, which can be interesting. But especially some of those really early podcasts are fantastic. I really enjoy the Retronauts.
So, yeah, I haven't listened to it in a while, but I did enjoy those. It is in my feed. And then whenever a new episode comes in, I just mark it as listened to.
Ah.
But I do like Chris Kohler, too, for those reasons. I love that he is a junkie for pawn shops and Salvation Armies. And just finding insane deals on old games. He'll come back with, you know, 6 Sega CD games that he got for $10. And just like, awesome. I want
to. Like, that's great. That's awesome.
That's what I want to do.
He's the guy who buys Sega CD games.
And he actually goes way back for me because he came to MAGFest 2.
No kidding.
When he was just a fledgling journalist interested in writing about games, like he had written for a handful of sites, like done nothing big. And he was talking about games journalism, and I was like, "Yeah, this guy's okay." And at this point, I don't know if he would remember me. I contacted him about a possible internship, and he remembered who I was at that point a couple years ago. So, you know, he may remember that thing. But yeah, totally, he was at MAGFest too, and now he writes for Wired's game, our heads up game life at Wired. So
that is badass.
And wrote a book. All right. The next person on my list is Ashley Baxter.
Okay.
She writes at rockersdelight.co.uk. It's hard not to be enchanted by her accent because she is Scottish.
That's pretty good.
But she is – I love her raw take on video games and her enthusiasm for it. You know, she never calls bullshit. She's the type of writer who just expresses how they feel about a game. And you know that they know what they're talking about. And you're willing to buy into it. And it's like super hardcore about like Dragon Age and stuff. Just like getting into like the real like nitty gritty details as she's playing through that game and her experiences with it. And it's a very refreshing style of writing when a lot of the blogs that I subscribe to I think are kind of pretentious. She's just, no, like I love video games. And I'm going to write about them in a good way. And she does the occasional video review or video feature where she talks about a handful of games and stuff. But
right.
Just someone a lot of people haven't heard of, so I totally recommend rockersdelight.co.uk. You know, not someone who make a professional career writing, and you can imagine writing for 1UP and that kind of thing, but refreshing to have in your RSS reader.
Awesome. On the same line, I wanted to recommend somebody a little different, and somebody who I respect but I don't really love, and that would be Michael Pachter.
Okay.
Do you know who he is?
Yes.
He is most frequently seen on the Bonus Round show at GameTrailers.com, as well as his new show, Pack Attack, which just started this year. He is interesting because he is a like
analyst.
Financial analyst from like Wedbush Morgan Securities, like a big firm.
Because you didn't look that up on Google because you knew it off the top of your head.
Well, I had it written down. Oh. I didn't just look it up right now. But, yeah, no, I wouldn't remember that.
Sorry.
But well, I only bring that up not to show like, oh, this is what I know. I just like no, like here's a big firm he works for. But there's a bunch of financial analysts that especially like bigger websites will cite like. But he seems really interesting because whenever I listen to him, I'm like, it seems like you really play games. Like, I don't know how, like, if you're like a crazy hardcore gamer, but you don't sound like you're coming out of your ass.
Yeah, that's such a problem with a lot of analysts will just look at numbers and spout things off and don't understand the culture of people who play games.
He's not afraid to make like weird, bold predictions. It's often fun analyzing him, you know, about how much stuff is going to cost. He always has great statistics on like the best-selling games, which are always fascinating and like totally conflict with your view of the gaming world. He comes from a completely different perspective. That is not like a fandom perspective, but like, no, listen, like you want to know like how Nintendo is doing, like here you go. And I think he brings a fresh, really honest, like financial side of video games. That isn't like, I guess, my number one interest, mm-hmm. but I find is cool to have. And I like the bonus round show because it's always him, a host, and two like usually game like journalist type people, which I think is nice to put there. Like, here's how enthusiastic I am about Game X, like Halo ODST, and here's like the sales expectations for it, and like often seeing how they'll match up, and like how each of them defines like what a good game is. I find that show very fascinating. I found him very fascinating on it. And like I said, I want to pick him because I think he's a neat voice, and I think he's totally different from everybody else on this list.
Yeah, people never give any respect to analysts because they think of them just as businessmen.
Right. And like I said, he obviously is a businessman, and like that's the perspective he's coming for. Like he's interested in like how these companies can make money. But he likes video games. He talks about games in a way that you're like, you actually like play Wii with your daughter, and like you have played some Halo and you dig it. And like doesn't pretend like no, I'm home playing 4 hours of PlayStation every night. Like it seems like he comes very genuinely like, yeah, I play some video games sometimes. Which I respect that. That honest like perspective. Like, I'm not going to oversell how much mm-hmm. I know games.
The last person on my list since how many do you have left?
I have two. Maybe I should go again.
Yeah, go again.
Okay. The fourth person on my list is Robert Ashley. Do you know who that is?
Yes.
Do you not like Robert Ashley?
I like his writing.
He does a podcast called A Life Well Wasted, which I love. Do you
really?
Not?
I do not.
For me, that is like, if I did not have a job, like that is the podcast that I would want to make.
I love the format, but I do not like the man. So describe A Life Well Wasted, like what the format of it is.
A Life Well Wasted is a completely different video game podcast. Most podcasts are like ours, where there's certainly some preparation that goes in, but we hit record and we talk for a while and then we hit stop and then we, you know, put it online, mm-hmm. basically. His sounds like a segment on All Things Considered.
Yes.
It is exactly – it has that public radio feel, lots of production, lots of musical interludes throughout. There's a narrative. It's like long-form journalism put into audio, and I love it. I think it is totally different. There's no schedule in these podcasts. He started the podcast up at the beginning of 2009, and there have been five episodes. It's seven on the feed, but some of them are broken up into two parts. But I think he takes unique approaches to games, whether it's like, you know, why do people play games, or like chronicling the history of the death of EGM. He comes from a totally different standpoint than anybody else, and I really love his podcast. I'm actually, it's funny. I actually think his writing is fine. I do not think it is as inspired as the show, mm-hmm. But as a fan of like what he is trying to mimic, and he is a like wannabe radio producer, so like he's certainly trying to like show off his skills at editing when he makes these. But I love it. I love the sound. I love the format. I think everybody should check it out. alifewellwasted.com.
I've totally wanted to do a podcast like that. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I would love to have a second form
be super fucking hard.
Yeah.
But like, how great would it be?
And you know, a lot of it depends on access. So there is another writer who I like, but he's not on this list. His name is Charles Pratt.
Right.
And he has Another Castle, which is his podcast, and he interviews you know, various people who I would consider more like on the academia side, like not like, you know, all your book writers, but a lot of thoughtful people who are talking about games. And I like that format as well. Very like interviewee, very thought provoking. And I would enjoy doing something like that. But when it comes down to it, this is what I need. Like in my heart of hearts, I need to like sit down with you for 2 hours and discuss games on this level.
It's more fun. Yeah. I mean, in terms of doing it, it's way more fun. Like that would be, I don't know how much I'd enjoy like making this podcast just because it seems like so much work and all that for, I mean, I don't know how much time he spends like sticking that hour segment into it, into like form, but, I have a lot of respect for it. And I like that unique sense. Like I said, as a huge, like This American Life fan and stuff like that, I like that, like constructed narrative and, all that. What's funny is like I like him not so much for his voice, but for his ability to get people on his podcast, have them speak into his microphone, and then chop that up to make it interesting.
That's very true.
I don't know if I would recommend him in the same way I would like a Chris Kohler, where like I'm interested in what he has to say a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in Robert Ashley's like vision of like getting stuff together and putting it on a recording. That's my recommendation.
So my last recommendation, I think this is a nice, easy reading academic book that I would recommend to people. It shouldn't be too expensive. And it's Alexander Galloway. And his book is Algorithms.
Isn't that a Grateful Dead song? Alexander Galloway, Galloway, Alexander Galloway. Isn't that a Grateful Dead song?
It's
a song called Alabama Getaway.
Oh. Haha. Say, gaming essays on algorithmic culture. And one thing that he just puts up like right up front, like the way he looks at games, is one of the ideas that I've really latched on to, which is that gaming, like games are actions.
Mm-hmm.
Like games don't exist unless things are happening, like unless you're doing something, and you can be doing something inside of the game playing, you could be pressing pause, you could be hacking code like outside of the game, etc. But I think that for this little book, this little thing, it's a good starter piece for anybody to read. Very accessible, writes about games you'd be interested in.
I like that idea. Would he argue like a movie doesn't exist unless it's playing? Like, is that the same type of?
I'm sure he would, but like, you know,
I understand why that's more important with a video game,
right? Like a movie doesn't exist unless it's playing, like a book, nothing exists unless you're aware of it. But at the same time, like, you know, it depends on how you're watching the movie as well. Like, is it a movie if it's on in the background?
Right. Like that. Right. Well, that's a really good point.
And so video games require you to interject. And he's of course not the first person to say that, you know, that is a necessary component of any sort of digital medium.
Right.
But I think he does a really good job of establishing these four directions of what it means for action in games. And I will let our friend Kevin explain further in his detailed analysis of it. So, but yeah, well, Alexander Galloway.
I'll finish with, you're not going to be surprised at my last entry. I feel that game journalism, lost a person. A superstar, a somebody whose mind was so unique that we have never recovered from. I feel like the internet is still a weaker place without Greg Kasavin writing on a regular basis.
I knew you'd put him on your list, and I was just going to let you do that. So, I'm glad you did.
I was conflicted simply because after he left GameSpot in January of 2007, his output has been next to nothing.
No,
His editor-in-chief position at GameSpot, where he had worked for, again, over 10 years, kind of parallel to Jeff Gerstmann for a while. Like, he was on the PC side, and Jeff was on the video game side, or on the console side, and then they interacted later. But they were the two voices of that, what made GameSpot so great in the early part of last decade. He left to go work for EALA, working on Command & Conquer 3, Red Alert 3, he's currently working on Spec Ops: The Line.
That game looks good, by the way.
It looks real good. That game looks raw.
I was never going to get that second thought, but that game looks good.
Greg Kasavin, though, was kind of a weird guy, a little antisocial. If you ever watch him in like video or audio reviews, but he thought about games in a complex and really forward way and a really unique way that I don't think has ever been replicated. The best place to go and check him out, I would say, would be to go to GameSpot and look at the old GameSpotting feature, which was a once a week where they would get a bunch of editors to just write an article on whatever they wanted. And some people were funny. Some people were just like, oh, I'm having a lot of fun with this game. But his were always really introspective and really deep and really interesting. One of the most memorable was he went through the exercise of reviewing real life as a video game, like the experience of life, which was very funny, but also like was interesting in the point of like
commenting on
game reviewing. Like, it was funny because he was obviously like graphics 10 out of 10. He was like, these are the best graphics I've ever seen in a video game. But like he would be smart and complain about – he goes, the worst part about it is the character creation. Not only do you have no input as to what your character looks like or its strengths and weaknesses, but you also can't like restart. You can't re-roll. It's just like you have to deal with what you get. And so it makes the game very unfair and very different experience. It's very, very funny and clever. His it always seemed like he was on a different level where everybody else was like always seemed to have an element of like, yeah, I'm having fun. I'm playing games. This is great. He really seemed to like think about it critically and care a lot about what he was telling people with his reviews. His reviews were always extremely long. If you look at the length of his text reviews, you know, going back to like his Halo 2 review or something like that, much, much longer than the average review then and now. You know, he was not as interested as, I mean, there's like their score was there. So you want to know what I think? It's fine. But he wasn't interested in making it as digestible as about like, this is what the game is.
And it makes sense that he ended up in game design for that reason. Like, I wish he was still writing and reviewing, but he, you know, he understands games from like the very basic mechanical rule based level and constructed his reviews based on that. So
you can still see him. He's on Twitter at Kasavin. And he had a blog for about a year at donpatchy.blogspot.com, which has been deleted.
It was depressing.
It was really fucking depressing. It was about basically how he never got to see his family in his life of game design and like shedded a real interesting light on like how proud he was of his work and what he was doing, but also like the toll it was putting on his family life. And also like he kind of didn't care about that. And like, what did that say about him? And like the fact that he like didn't really mind that he was like not with his wife was depressing him even more. Like, it was a weird block.
Yeah. I understand why it does not exist anymore, but
it was still an interesting like voice that you've never really heard, just like a regular like designer. Because it wasn't like he went from being editor in chief of GameSpot. It's not like he went to some like lead programmer on a game. Like, no. He went to the bottom of the rack on the game design level and has had to like work his way up. I do believe he has a producer role on Spec Ops. But I'm not entirely sure. I just think he's a cool dude. He's got a really unique voice, and he's worth tracking down. Like I said, please go on GameSpot and find some of his older videos and reviews. You will not be disappointed.
Brilliant. Well, of course, the list means that other people are going to submit. So we have a handful of things. Three people have submitted. We saved the best, aka the longest, for last. So as we wrap this up, friend of the show Ray wrote in that he likes Jeremy Parrish, who wrote for 1UP, and he's on Brush and Knots. And
yeah, I like Jeremy.
He does a PDF, the print, basically print-styled magazine called GameSpite that you can find on GameSpite.net. Lots of really good opinions about games. Someone I wish I could read in a more condensed form, perhaps, as opposed to all over the place. But yeah, good writer. A lot of people love Jeremy Parrish.
Yeah.
Say Kat Bailey, who I had to look up. She writes for 1UP, G4, GamePro, and a website called What They Play. And I know nothing of her, but you can find her on Twitter. She's at @_KATBot, at the Kat Bot, Kat Hi. Bailey. So I will have to look into what she's done specifically. Also, looks a guy whose name is I can never pronounce this guy's Twitter handle. It's AEZ.
Eziel? That would be my guess, because isn't the AE like the in like ether pronounced just like an E?
Yeah, so it would be.
I'd say Eziel.
Eziel. No, because Zeal, because it's Z-E-L, so there's no Zeal. It'd be just Zell. Eziel.
Oh yeah, Eziel.
See, it's hard. But his name is Dennis. I'm not sure what his last name is. But he writes for a blog called Vorpal Bunny Ranch, blogspot.com, I believe, and also gaygamer.net. And he brings the interesting, you know, gay perspective to playing games and how things are represented in games, and does a good job of elucidating his position to the medium.
Gotcha.
So I've read his stuff, and I knew who that was. And he said that he can't think of any others off the top of his head, but not Tim Roger.
Oh, goodness.
Tim Roger writes for actionbutton.net, and he sometimes gets linked to because it's like, oh, here's a guy who's, like, snarky, and he gives really good games, like, twos, because, like, they're not really, like, pushing anything. It's just like, oh, man, Final Fantasy 13, it's a two. Who cares?
He Joe Squirrel
thinks of himself as a clever writer, and I do not like his website at all. And he writes, like, his articles are super, super long too. I'm sure his opinions, like a handful of his opinions, are okay, but his position that he takes, I do not like. So do not read that website, which I will not mention again.
I like Campbell's Picks. Campbell, who you've heard on the show before, he simply pits Jeff Gerstmann, Ryan Davis, Vinny Caravella, and Brad Shoemaker, the four brain trusts who launched Giant Bomb. As we mentioned before, Giant Bomb, greatest website on the internet. You should go check it out. And then for the fifth, he put, hey, him.
Yeah.
So at Namestolen on Twitter.
Say.
He is a pretty rad dude, so you should follow him.
I read more of his music reviews than his video game stuff. You need to write more, goddammit.
That's true, yeah. I think he's – let me say he was phasing – because he's not an editor with the Tableau anymore, right?
The Tableau. if I want to snare my mate, this Tableau I shall recreate.
There you go.
Okay. All right. And last up, Jay and I will pass this back and forth.
Let's do it.
So Kevin writes, Dear Low Score Podcast, hello. I would like to congratulate you on your successes. Don't know what he's referring to, but thank you.
Thanks. I assume he is referring to our incredibly successful podcast, downloaded by millions of listeners every day.
I have devised a list, the list.
I really appreciate him writing the word list in all caps, because this isn't the list. It's the list.
Still needs the in front of it. It's a the list.
Right. A the list is proper grammar.
Right. To add to your roll call, please consider it. I've done two academic types. Bobby can further explain why I like them if my little blurbs don't go into enough detail. And three others. The academic ones are serious nominees, and the others waver between serious and not. It should be noted that one thing that interests me about this is that for a number of years, many of the review mags that were not zines and tied to publishing personalities ran the reviews without bylines. So some of those earlier review journalisms, and that would be stuff like EGM, where you had your pseudonyms that were publishing reviews, etc. Ran without bylines. So where was I? So much of the early review journalism, much of which borders on fluff or PR, is effectively anonymous. But as with the emergence of creative directors, auteur, the end of anonymous design, video games are finally being criticized by face-to-name real people. So the first person on his list was somebody that I chose, which was Alexander Galloway. Now, Galloway, I let Kevin summarize this, Galloway is a professor of media ecology at NYU. Though I think his PhD is technically in comparative literature, so is Ian Bogost, if I'm not mistaken. You're not. His work has mainly been on emergent forms of digital culture. Like many of the best writers on any aspect of artistic production, he is a practitioner, that is, game designer, code writer, digital artist, as well as a critic. He does not exclusively write about or design games, but for podcast purposes, I'd suggest his book, Gaming, Essays on Algorithmic Culture, and game-related essays like StarCraft or Balance, which is available on his website. Yes, StarCraft or Balance, totally should check that out if you're interested in game design at all. My reason for nominating him is that he's one of the few people I know who's made a coherent, interdisciplinary case for why consideration of video games is absolutely essential to the contemporary critical thought. His background is in a type of critical theory, namely Foucault, Deleuze, Habermas, though these names may not mean much to everyone, that tends to get bogged down in definitional minutiae. Yet part of what makes his work so strong is the ways in which he's able to move beyond the shibboleths of the late 1970s critical thought, see his revising with Eugene Thacker, who works at my school, of Deleuze in his book Networks, and have the ideas serve as games and vice versa. In short, if you're interested in things like political economy, the politics of electronic media, yes, he contends there are political relays and messages bound up in digital systems all the way down to the level of protocol, and issues of control, i.e. questions like, is the act of playing a video game ultimately liberating or distributing or restricting, look into his work. This definitely falls more on the side of game studies that I would consider Kevin to be interested in, which is falling on the cultural studies side. But like I said, essays in algorithmic culture is a very accessible, coherent read that pulls in a lot of different sources, doesn't necessarily pin video games down to one singular thing, but explores them from a multitude of contexts using what I consider to be a very sound framework. So, Jay, why don't you read number two here?
All right. Number two. The Writers of Digital Play, The Interaction of Technology, Culture, and Marketing by Stephen Klein, Nick Dyer-Wetherford, and Greg DePuyter. Sorry if I didn't pronounce any of those right. If Galloway brings ideological analysis to the actual composition and programming of games, then these three authors can be commended for their economic analysis of the way games are bought, sold, and played. The book is slightly old now by game study standards, yet two of the authors have a more recent work that I've yet to read. This isn't a business book like Smart Bomb or David Sheff's Game Over. Rather, it is concerned with investigating and critiquing the video game industry on the grounds of social justice and equality. I won't go into it here, but there's plenty in the book to enthrall and aggravate gamers. Critiques of militarized masculinity, the trope from which video games seem unable to escape. Discussions of the inbuilt business reality of video games, where the poorest of the poor do not get to regularly access this new cultural form precisely because of the generally huge investment of money required to by popular media accounts. Do it properly.
It's got Mega Man on the cover.
You've got it. It's got Mega Man on the cover. I'm interested. He mentions David Sheff's Game Over, which is one of the few video game books I've actually read, which I found super interesting, less from a business perspective and more from a like history of Nintendo perspective.
Right. That book is still really good at that. It is important for us to have these texts that go through the histories of
right
of
straight up like here's what happened. Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways, where games have come from and how we've experienced them culturally has a lot to do with how they were produced and mm-hmm. how one thing flowed into the next. The idea of these video games as systems, as platforms that create more products. It's interesting because this is definitely a Kevin book.
Right.
I've read it. I enjoyed it, but it is not as relevant to my research, yet it is super important and needs to exist.
I like the idea of somebody talking about militarized masculinity and like these military, like aggro, like men fantasies and games that I haven't ever heard idiots not talk about. If that makes sense. Or I should reverse that. That I've topics that I think are interesting and valid, but every time I hear them talked about like in the media and stuff are by like total morons
yes.
who like have no business talking about games. Like the fact that like video games are really violent and like that's maybe something we should talk about is not like a dumb topic. Like it's dumb to say video games are violent, therefore video games are bad. Like no. But like maybe there is something to this like what are we doing to ourselves and like this like romanticizing like the wartime experience. I think that's interesting and like worth looking into. As somebody who enjoys military shooters who are living out some kind of, inlet fantasy of killing Russian people.
You just wish you were like a Warhammer-style, big-shouldered, broad-shouldered man. That's all.
Yes. I do really like playing as dwarfs. I don't know what that says to me. I mean, it's not like I'm not short. I'm not super tall either. Maybe I might live it out some sort of like short, broad-shoulder fantasy. I don't know. Maybe I just really want to wield a big axe. I think that has to do more with it than anything.
Can I have two swords? That's who I want to be.
Yeah.
This is the most interesting review of anyone so far. I find Jeremy Parrish's stuff relatively readable.
I like how that's good enough to make it to his list.
My taste tends to run parallel to his, and while I don't read everything he writes, I agree it's hard to find everything he writes, I think it is one of the central online critics of our time. I'd agree in that. It's a shame that he's associated with the otherwise sensationalist 1UP.
I think 1UP's gotten better in most recent years. Like, their forum is still terrible. And their website is still, like, really hard to decipher, like, what's going on. But some of the people they have working there are, like, really, really great talent.
Yeah, I never go there. One of the problems I find is that there are so many blogs on 1UP, and it's hard to figure out, like,
there's too much.
Does this person write for 1UP, or is this like just a dude who has a blog on 1UP? I can't tell the difference.
Well, that's one of the things that we like, again, going back to how good Giant Bomb is Giant Bomb doesn't have any freelance writers. And they're basically like, not that they're not good writers and not that they don't have anything to say, but like, we like saying, like, this is Giant Bomb's perspective. This isn't somebody who Giant Bomb has paid. Like, this is somebody who's like bought in to like our perspective. And like, you can take that for what it is. Like, if you think we're idiots, that's fine. But like, you know us. You know that we're idiots. It's not some rake rando we picked off the street. Which I think is nice as an outlet who's not interested in reviewing every little game that comes out. And is not interested in giving you a review. They're interested in giving you their review.
Next on this list is Chris Kohler.
Indeed. He says, owing to old ties, still read Chris Kohler's stuff on occasion. He's the central editor of Wired's Game Life blog. From the comments on his post, it would seem that he's becoming more and more divisive based on his stated tastes, but I feel as if evaluative game blogs thrive on this quirky disclosure. Again, I don't take what he says as gospel, but if you think back to undergrad political philosophy and agree with John Rawls' criteria for making an informed decision, part of which was a deferral to a coterie of established judges or connoisseurs, then he's a good bet. And that is definitely a Kevin way of saying that, but I agree.
Yes.
He is a voice that I feel is very valuable to hear in my game playing and purchasing and critical thinking experiences.
And typical to Kevin fashion, I should mention that he apparently prefaced his last of the list by saying that he did not look at any of the people that were on, he did not like go through and like double check to make sure who was on the GameSpot character battle, which is why he had the double of Vincent.
Right.
He wanted to preface that, but he says, number five, my inability to think of a fifth person reflects more on the fact that I don't read nearly as much on games as I used to, even as compared to 2 years ago, and less to do with the lack of good writing available. And this is an interesting point, because I had trouble making my list because I read so much. And a lot of cases, I don't remember who I read. Like, it's all lumped into my gaming blogs category on my Google Reader.
It's interesting. It's interesting how, like, Google Reader and Twitter have changed my life. Where I used to go and sit and read stuff, now I feel like stuff on the internet is just like some kind of waterfall. And like, when I have a chance in my day, like, I go and stand under the waterfall. And if I've missed water that's like fallen, like when I was asleep, or like, oh, I didn't have time this morning, I guess I just missed that. Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems like this constant flow of information that sometime I'm standing under and sometimes not.
It's extremely difficult. At one point I had been subscribed, you know, 100 gaming, like basically every gaming blog possible. And I got to the point where I was like, I don't need to be involved in all of this. Like, I don't
know.
Yeah, I thought, I was like, well, these are people who'd fall into like the criticism category. Excuse me, I would say. And I was like, you know, it's not like a community that I necessarily need to be engaged with, and I'm fine. I've unfollowed writers on Twitter and then refollowed them. I embarrassingly, at the Art History of Games, refollowed a guy who goes by the pseudonym LB Jeffries, which is Jimmy Stewart's character's name in Rear Window. But he writes for Pop Matters. And it's just some point I was just like, unfollow, and like delete the blog and stuff. And I came back to it and I was like, you know what? Actually, my bad. Like, this guy's okay.
That's cool.
LB Jeffries, like, thumbs up. I enjoy your writing, and it takes a minute to come back to it. But I just find myself just being overwhelmed, and at some point saying, fuck it all.
It's hard. That's what happened to me. I mean, even this is so sad, but I had a busy weekend, and I didn't check Twitter for like 36 hours. And I went back trying to catch up, and like, I clicked down three pages and I hadn't even gotten to the last hour's worth of tweets. And I was like, fuck it. I was like, no chance. I'm going to catch up. Just like, fuck it. So whatever happened the last day and a half, I missed. Moving on.
It's weird that we think that we need to know those kinds of things now.
When did that happen? Like a year ago, I don't think I was using Twitter hardly at all.
That's bizarre. But... oh my God. Good discussion topic.
Good discussion. A lot of good stuff.
All over the place.
If you've got lists, if you've got discussion topics to suggest to us, if you've got questions to ask of us, you can send those to lowscorepodcast@gmail.com.
please visit the blog. You can post your list of reviewers. We'll read them off on the next show. We might not go into full detail, but we'll give people names and websites they can go to.
LittleScorePodcast.blogspot.com.
Our awesome album art is there. You can get links to, you know, the music that's on the show, that kind of stuff. And just engage with us, because email doesn't have to be the only way. Twitter. But Twitter, a huge fan.
Twitter, we're huge fans. That's a way to follow us. Follow Low Score Podcast. That's the podcast. Follow Bokista. That's Bobby. Follow Jay Ford. That's me.
That is you. And anything else, just most importantly, tweet, tell your friends, share links.
Tell your friends, man. Pass the word around. That's, you know, we'll do this because we like people to hear it and interact with us. So tell your friends. Let us know.
We will catch you next time.
Peace out. Bye, everybody.